Today's show is brought to you by Casper. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/Dana and using the promo code Dana.
A world gone insane. An upside-down civilization cannot be real. A world of madness and terror.
It's the Dana Gould Hour.
Happy February, March. It's a brand new edition of the Dana Gould Hour podcast. I like to think of the show as an audio Pop-Tart. You never know when it's going to jump out at you. But in the interest of some sort of regularity, and with my new awareness that nature abhors a vacuum and that I, like many others, need a deadline now and again, we are trying to get the show out on the first or second of every month, except on those instances in which we don't. Is the world throwing up roadblocks to make that difficult? Oh, yes. The good news is, these roadblocks are sort of cool. For example, for the past year, I've been working on a proposed television show for IFC called Stand Against Evil. It is, for lack of a better term, a cross between The X-Files and All in the Family. And I am happy to announce that it just got picked up to series, and it will be on your televisions this fall. Yeah, this fall. Gee. I know what you're thinking. That's kind of soon. I know that's what I'm thinking. And we still have to do everything. But we're going to do our best to get everything on the TV show and the podcast done on time. The good news is this. Me and spare time are a terrible combination. So hopefully this will all work out for the best. In the meantime, you have an amazing episode of the show right in front of you. The estimable Greg Proops. He of the Smartest Man in the World podcast is here. And his new book, The Smartest Book in the World. You can follow him at Greg Proops, GREGPROOPS. 1 G, 2 O's. Actually, 2 G's. But not 3. Also, the creator of one of my favorite podcasts, Ken Reed. He of TV Guidance Counselor fame is here. Follow him on the Twitter at Kenneth W. Reed, KENNETHWREID. I will say, although we look nothing alike, lucky for Ken, all of our other similarities are so striking, it got to the point of being somewhat creepy. And you can actually hear me getting spooked out as the interview progresses. Me? I will be in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania at Helium, the comedy club on March 3rd, 4th, and 5th, and at the Wheeler Opera House in Aspen, March 11th. Come on out to that, my Denver peeps. Then, I will be returning to one of my favorite places in the whole wide country, Portland, Oregon, to play the Helium there on March 24th, 5th, and 6th. So lots of places to see me do my clown act. Details and ticket links on the live appearances page at danagould.com. And hey, while you're there, why not become a supporter of the podcast? You can become a member or, if you like, and don't think we don't appreciate it, just use danagould.com to click on our Amazon banner and shop away. But for now, sit back, relax, enjoy. It's Sunday, high above Mulholland Drive, here in scenic Hollywood, California, where the powers that be and their friends hang out. I am joined by Ken Reed. Ken is a very, very funny comedian who hails from my home state of Massachusetts.
This is the sound of my voice.
And Ken is not only just recorded his album entitled
The Vanity Project Volume 1, Hollywood.
How is that not a Liza Minnelli album? One.
Well, wait till you hear it. You'll ask the same question.
Life is a cabaret.
I'd talk about Mama.
Mama and Benny. She dated a guy named Benny. No, Benzedrine. Yeah. But also, Ken is the producer and star of one of my favorite podcasts. The most fun I had this year, I think.
Oh, thank you.
The TV Guidance Counselor. If you don't listen to TV Guidance Counselor, you should avail yourself of it. Here are the podcasts that I listen to. TV Guidance Counselor, You Must Remember This, which is must listen for anybody who listens to my podcast would love You Must Remember This, and Radiolab.
Yeah.
But tell the nice people in podcast land about TV Guidance Counselor.
I have more or less every issue of TV Guide, at least from 65 to 2000. It gets a little spotty before that. Plus, there's regional variations.
That's also your opening line when you're meeting the ladies.
Yes, yes. So I have them all at my house, and I rotate them out from this rotating rack in my living room. They're just kind of in the corner, like a display rack they would have, and I kind of rotate them out. But when people used to come over, they'd say, why do you have these? And I'd always say, an alibi. Because they'd be like, where was I on the night of what? I was watching this. But really, I just
and TV Guide is still being published.
It is not.
It's a different format now.
Yeah, it's more like an Entertainment Weekly now.
Right.
But it still vestigially has the grid in it for no reason. Because,
right.
And it's not regional anymore. So it's national, and so it doesn't really matter the variations of when
it was,
plays when.
It was such a big deal. And it's one of those things that I never think about. Like, TV Guide came out on Tuesday for the following week.
Right.
And I would go to Rico's, which was our local grocery store, where you'd get it and then you'd go home and you'd go through it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And look, they would list all the movies that were playing. So you'd see if there's any horror movies that you wanted to see, any science fiction movies you wanted to see, Planet of the Apes movies. You mark it and you'd call it Wednesday at 4 o'clock. I'm watching Battle TV's for the mine. Planet of the Apes. Yeah, TV's mine.
Yeah, yeah.
If it was a Sunday and if it was up against a sporting event, you're screwed.
Right.
But yeah, and you'd call it. And yeah, and you'd go through the TV Guide and see what you wanted to see.
Yeah, and it was...
Now you can just get it on your phone.
So on the show, what people do is they'll pick an old issue and then they write down what they'd watch that week, just like we're talking about, and then we talk about what they'd watch.
It is amazing because TV is one of those things, like food, there's comfort TV and there's comfort food.
That's oh, yeah. Really, and especially, funny. I think for people of like our generation and a little bit younger, it was really important because
I'm in my early 90s.
Yeah.
And you are.
I'm 71 years old. Well, years young.
Yeah, 71 years young.
I just blew out my candles from my birthday in October. I did them one at a time because of my sciatica.
That would be a great, definitely. I'd blown out my candles.
The last candle.
Interesting fact. And I think we actually talked about this on TV Guidance Counselor. The first thing that happens after you die is that you release your bowels, which does sort of throw a monkey wrench into all those romantic movies.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'll love you forever.
Yeah. When I was in high school.
Chili.
This kid has since died, which I feel bad about. But
great story if it ends there.
He died.
Like he did.
He shit himself to death. This kid, Brad, was walking down the hallway and he's like, I'm going to fart, because that's what you do when you're like 15. And then he did, and this Metco student, which was a program we had in Boston where they would ship inner city black youths to the suburbs, goes...
It's called busing.
Yeah, she goes, Brad, you shit yourself, because it just lingered worse. And he goes, a little. And this kid never lived it down. And I used to talk about it on stage because he was the first kid I went to high school with that I found out who died. And I was trying to remember something because people were sharing on his Facebook wall, like fond memories. And I'm like, all I have is I shit myself.
Shit himself on his way to earth science.
Yeah. I was like, and I'm not going to share that. Like, that's not remember when he shit himself a little. And then the other thing was
shitting yourself a little is kind of like being a little pregnant. Or
you did it or you didn't.
Yeah. You did or you didn't.
Yeah.
Whether it's an M&M or a yodel, you're in or you're out.
It's the kind of thing where if you shit yourself a little, you might as well just push it
you
to it. Yeah. Because it's your story, you shit yourself. Like, make it go for it, you know?
Anchors away.
Have some self-respect. You know, if you do it, do it.
Own it. Own it. Yeah. So, don't be Pat Boone. Be Iggy Pop. No, get out there. Take off your shirt.
Although Pat Boone's probably shitting himself more than Iggy Pop is these days. I would imagine. Yeah.
I laid an egg.
Good golly, miss.
Well, Elvis supposedly, towards the end, Elvis Presley, not Elvis Costello,
Elvis Mitchell. The end,
Elvis Mitchell. Elvis Mitchell.
I say towards the end because I'm going to kill him this week.
Poor Elvis. He's nicest guy in the world, Elvis Mitchell. But Elvis Presley, because of all the drugs, his endocrine system were kind of shut down.
Well, yeah, and he was doing a lot of pain medicine too, so he had like no bowels.
Yeah. And there's a lot of shitting his pants or a lot of sharding.
Marilyn Monroe too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Sharding is not good when you wear white jumpsuits.
No.
And a lot of impacted stuff when they...
Yeah.
When they,
he was like those petrified forests.
We always end up back here.
Yeah, it's a lot of shit.
Like the seventh... This is like the seventh time I brought up Elvis Presley's post-mortem.
It was really weird. He invited me over to his house. He told me it wasn't going to be about
and
that.
He showed me these rocks, and they are clearly not Elvis's impacted shit. But
he goes, do you know what this is?
If you hold these, this is what it weighed.
I did a podcast with Karen Duffy, who was Duff from MTV. Jim Carrey got gallstones on the set of Dumb and Dumber and got taken off the set. And she goes, I want those. And he had them made into earrings for her. And she showed them to me.
That's fantastic.
I was like, these are Jim Carrey's gallstones. You think they were gallstones. It might have been kidney stones.
Kidney stones, yeah.
Yeah. The thing for me was my childhood, not fun, not good. We had no money.
Good to have you on board.
Yep. And I paid for the subscription myself because it was my thing that I look forward to every week. And now, not to get too armchair psychology on it, but it was the thing that gave me, in a chaotic environment, gave me some order.
I completely understand, Ken, more than you know.
And you could say, look, I planned my week. I'm in control of this. And it gave you something to look forward to. So you were like, no matter how bad this week is, this show will be on Thursday night at 8 and nothing can change it.
Wow. No, that rings my bell. That's a bullseye. And the other weird thing that I would do is I started around fourth or fifth grade arranging so I would get mail.
Oh, that's what I did all the time.
Because it gives something to look for. Ooh, I might get mail today. A lot of stuff ordered from Captain Company.
Yep. Junk catalogs.
Yeah. And just like
Finger Hut. Were you a Finger Hut guy?
I was a lot of stuff from the back of Famous Monsters. Yep. I've subscribed to Starlog and all that stuff. So like, I'm going to get mail today. And it's just like a reason to want to go home.
That's what I used to do. I got super into zine culture in the 90s. I used to get Faction 5. I used to steal stamps, and then I figured out a way you could reuse stamps. You'd scrub them and reuse them so you could get self-addressed stamped envelopes. And I would just get tons and tons and tons of zines just to get mail.
Yeah, just to get mail.
Just because it gave you something to look forward to.
And what were the shows that were your comfort shows growing up?
Newhart was a huge one, and that was my Monday night show because Monday was always
the Vermont Newhart. Vermont Newhart show.
Okay. Which I liked the Bob Newhart show, but the Vermont Newhart show I loved more because it was weirder than Night Flight. So I had another weird thing.
USA's Night Flight?
Yeah.
Oh, me too.
That changed my life. Absolutely.
Really? Yeah. Rhonda Shear.
That was USA Up All Night.
Oh, okay.
And Carolyn.
I do remember Night Flight too.
Night Flight was predated it by a few years, and I had this weird.
I remember the opening credits of flying through over the LA Basin.
Yes.
Which made me in the late 70s. It was that and Fridays.
Yeah.
Which was the ABC ripoff of Saturday Night Live that was actually very underrated. It's a very
good.
Larry David came off that
show. Melanie Chartoff.
Michael Richards came off that show. Larry David came off that show.
The star of Jekyll and Hyde Together Again.
Yes. Don't tell me his name.
And The Jerk 2, the made-for-TV sequel to The Jerk.
Who was it? What's his name?
Mark Blankenfield.
Yeah, all these old comedy story guys. Melanie Chartoff, the very pretty Melanie
Very Chartoff. Pretty. Looks great today. Has a U.S. patent.
On what?
She invented a gray water recycling system.
God love her.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
She must live out here.
She does. Yeah. I've had her on the show. She's nice as can be. She's great.
It's so weird because I'm friends with Lorraine Newman.
Yeah.
And it's so weird to be friends with these people that you watched on TV in high school.
I'd love to one day meet them.
Yeah. And then it's like, I'm actually going to go have dinner with them.
It's crazy. I mean, even not to make you uncomfortable, it's like that for me too. I mean, I used to watch, you were the guy.
I'm so uncomfortable right now.
I was growing up watching these things, and especially USA Network, like Real Wild Cinema. Boston comedy in the 80s was very like the fucking guy and a Chinese waiter.
Yeah.
But when I would see you do stuff and it was smart. smarter and talking about things that I was into.
Right, right.
And
right.
I knew you were from Massachusetts. I was like, oh, you cannot be a complete piece of shit.
Yeah.
And still do this.
And you know who that was for me was Rick Overton.
Yeah.
Here's a comedian who likes the stuff that I like. Like Rick was a sci-fi guy and he, in his act had tread yeah. in those areas. And Ken Rogerson from Boston yep. also had a very, still does, a truly brilliant comedian. And his act had a very Baroque sense of lunacy to it that I stole when I learned how to write. And I remember just being, you know, a teenager in Massachusetts, yep. as you were. I was in Hopedale and you were in Melrose.
Yep.
Watching USA up all night and all these shows that took place in Los Angeles.
Which seemed a billion years away.
A billion years away. And the idea like that I could one day go out there and be a part of it was so, like I used to go to Disneyland a lot.
Yeah.
And I still do. Because the idea of when we were a kid going to Disneyland was right up there with going to the moon.
Oh, yeah. There's yeah, no
it was
way.
Not in the docket.
No, not at all.
Yeah. And so to go and do that was insane. I remember watching the Pee Wee Herman show at the Roxy, and it was so late 70s, early 80s Los Angeles.
Which was
and,
everything I love, that punk yeah. rock, that yeah, Gary Panter.
Yeah, Gary Panter. Yeah. You knew that John Doe and Exene were, yep. like he was friends with Exene.
Yeah. That Slash magazine, yeah, the whole thing.
That
yeah.
I loved. Oh, yeah. Fuck.
Repo Man is, I always yeah. say to people, if you want to understand me, watch Repo Man, and you'll be like, Ken makes more sense now.
Yeah.
And I had this weird thing.
Or the movie that I just became aware of recently, the movie Van Nuys Boulevard.
Yes, yes.
Not to be confused with Hollywood Nights with Robert Willis.
Right, right. Or Hollywood Boulevard. Yeah, the character
Sunset
Chooch.
Boulevard with Wings Hauser?
Wings Hauser's Sunset Boulevard?
That I would in. Never drown. It is a sun-dappled winter day here in Southern California, high atop Mulholland Drive and Falcon's Lair Recording Studios. With temps dipping down into a blustery winter lower 90s, I am sitting here with the author of a new book entitled The Smartest Book in the World. He has a podcast entitled The Smartest Man in the World and a new comedy album entitled In the Ballpark. Please welcome the estimable and urbane Greg Proops.
This is the sound of my voice.
Perfect. Only five takes and we nailed it.
That's what they call me. Five take Proops.
Five takes and they nailed it. Now, Greg, people want to pick up the smartest book in the world. What is it?
It's 300 pages of pure goodness. And
is it a random? You can open it up to any page?
Yes. It's one of those kind of books. It's a concordance. It's a you know, bunch of different things. A potpourri, a pastiche. Right. So there's different chapters on different things that I talk about in the podcast or that I like. Movies and records.
Yeah.
I go through punk and glam and all my favorite genres. And then also stuff on history, Negro League baseball, politics, this and that, women, feminism, and then a thing that came up on the podcast that was go ahead.
Everything from Negro League baseball to feminism.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's all you need.
Okay. And for people who are fans of both of those things, I think this book sure. is your book.
Sure. I go to the Negro League science fiction convention circuit.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of people dressed as Sisko from Deep Space Nine.
I was going to say a lot of cosplay dressed as the cat from Red Dwarf.
Cosplay, of course, now known as rape.
Yeah.
I hope he doesn't get depressed and commit sue a frizzle frazzle. But yeah, you were talking about punk. Because one of the things that I remember, a story that you told me, full disclosure, I've known Greg for a dog's age. You were telling me you grew up in San Francisco.
Yeah.
In the late, came of age in the late 70s, early 80s, yeah. like myself. You were walking around San Francisco and you saw a sign that said, the only band that matters.
Yeah.
Free concert in Golden Gate Park. And you knew automatically that it was
The Clash.
And you saw The Clash for free in Golden Gate Park.
And I saw them at Civic Center and also at the Temple Beautiful in 1978. My cousin Donnie and I drove up from San Carlos. And they had, this is the punk era in a nutshell. It was at, next door to Jim Jones Temple.
Really?
Right, yeah.
Before he went to Jonestown?
Right after. And so
okay.
This was right after he went to Jonestown and everything happened. So his name was still up. It said Reverend Pastor Jim Jones on the sign and everything. And this was two doors down, and it was falling apart. Jewish temple, but they'd absconded it and taken it over and made it into a venue. So there were sagging balconies and the names of Jewish donors all over the walls. And there was an opening band for the Clash. And then there was a band after the Clash, because that's what we did in punk days, right? So this poor band came out after the Clash.
Oh, God, you get to follow the Clash.
Yeah, and everybody went, boo. And they went, the guy, I remember the singer went, yeah, you guys really knock us out, man. You know, and the Clash was awesome because they were still full of energy and I'm sure jinked out on every manner.
Sure.
Joe's drummer's eyes rolled back up into his head, and Mick Jones was flinging himself around the stage. And then as I saw them as the years went by, they became a little less, you know, Joe was still pretty committed, but Mick, by that, the last time I saw them, Mick was just kind of up there, down, you know.
Yeah. Mick became the strummer.
Yeah. You know, and he didn't.
I saw them in 82 opening for The Who RFK. And they were, by that time. By that time, they were wearing Clash brand army fatigues.
Right. When I first saw them, and they were like supposed to be this underground commando unit who talked to their fans and all this jazz. And on another Clash note, since we've started there, the first time I went to England to do Who's Line in 89,
you are one of the big stars of Whose Line Is It Anyway in England and in the States.
Yeah, so the show that we like to call Why Not Prepare Something Funny.
Right.
And
for good reason, Noah.
the cat that was the PA on the show goes, you want to meet me for a drink at the French House on Dean Street, right? And I'd never been anywhere in London. I'd never been anywhere out of the country except like Canada. And so I took a cab from
of the States.
Right. I took a cab from my hotel and I said, French House on Dean Street. And the cab driver pulls up and Joe Strummer walked out the door. And that was like my first, and I went, that's Joe Strummer. And because he's an English cab, he went, yeah, so it is. And then years later, I was doing a crap gig in Dallas. At the Improv.
Don't be redundant.
I wasn't right. Little Jack Ruby's place, cute little place.
Yeah, here at the Carousel.
Yeah. And
that's always been my line about club owners. Yeah. Hard to believe the occupation that gave the world Jack Ruby could produce some loose screws.
And I was dying every night at this club. It was two black comics and me, one ahead of me. And so the black crowd was politely watching me each night, which is worse than being booed, right? They would
minor
laughter, you know.
Yeah. And can hear people clearing their throat but trying to be quiet about it. Or just even get the
yeah. And then this ain't funny, you know.
Yeah.
But it was the Thursday. It was like before it all started. It was the weeknight. And a band had come in called The Farm. I don't know if you remember them.
I know the restaurant in Beverly Hills.
Right. No affiliation as far as I know.
Well, as far as you know.
They were kind of groovy and there was too many of them. That was that era. It was like 89, 90 when there was always too many people in a band. And,
Or as I call it, the era of the bolo tie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I was as guilty as anyone else. I might have been wearing a bolo tie.
Oh, I know. I think I have photos of you in a bolo tie. With a skull shirt and a bolo tie.
Mm-hmm. I had no respect. And this band came in. And they go, there's
By the way, during that same period, I was Mr. Big Sideburns in a suede coat.
Oh, I remember your outfit. There's a picture of the three of us at Comedy Day in 1988. It's like you and me and Jennifer, and our outfits are
pretty great.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to say that you can tell exactly what year it is, but it's like looking at a picture of Lincoln during the Civil War. Like, that's from 1864, I think, by what they're wearing.
I had a very... If you want to know how I looked in 1989, look at any picture of Mickey Dolenz from 1966. A lot of double-breasted suede coats, a lot of hair, big sideburns, and striped T-shirts. That was my look. I had it down.
Oh, yeah.
I was like the Buffalo Springfield's advance man.
You wore Levi's with like black dress shoes, like brogues, little brogues.
Yeah, I had brogues, and then I had some creepers.
Yeah.
Yeah. My father shat himself when he saw me wearing creepers, which I can understand if you don't know what creepers are. It does look like someone's wearing pie.
Yeah, those are awfully spongy.
What the fuck are you wearing? Creepers.
Cakes on my feet?
Yeah.
No,
I'm wearing pie. Yeah.
No, there's one year I think I wore a boater to Comedy Day. There's a picture of me in a boater. One year a red teddy jacket, one of those long jackets with black jeans, with like drain pipes, you know, like, oh yeah. Well, it was San Francisco. I thought you had every right to do whatever you wanted.
San Francisco.
Tom Kenny dressed like a rockabilly star in those days with pink sport coat.
In those days.
Yeah, and every day.
He still does, yeah. God bless him.
No, we all had a shtick. And trees to wear the chaps.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about being a comedian. Ian, is that we have to talk and talk, but we have to tell people about Tree. But first, that's the beautiful thing about being a comedian is you get to dress like a rock star and pretend you're a rock star, but you don't have to know how to play an instrument.
No, and no one treats you like a rock star.
And nobody treats you like a rock star.
People don't sit in rapt attention and they're not excited when you come in.
But in that era, there was as much drugs as in the rock scene.
Oh, absolutely. I think you're right. In that era more, I think.
Yeah, in the late 70s, it's hard to describe to people now. In the late 70s and the early 80s, and we sort of got into this in the other interview with Ken Reed about the Wonderland Murders, which is right down the street.
Yes.
Just how much in I think in all aspects of entertainment, television, movies, music, certainly comedy, I know firsthand, cocaine was ubiquitous. You could not get away from it. I, as a just an open micer comedian in Boston, saw so much cocaine put into people's noses. It's mind-boggling. Wow. And then you just look at, you know, Johnny Carson had a Titanic cocaine problem. Oh, he had his septum replaced.
Right. Like, Carlin, Fryer.
Yeah, all of these guys just... And then in movies, like the famous... one of the first big Hollywood debacles, Heaven's Gate. Literally, like, they're holding up production, waiting for the helicopter full of cocaine.
Right, because we can't do this without the coke.
Yeah, I know a guy who worked on the show Fridays that was ABC's version of Saturday Night Live in the late 70s,
sure.
early 80s.
Mark Langfield.
Larry David, Michael Richardson. Yeah. And this gentleman, he was a PA, and his job was on Friday, go get coke.
Which I assume for them was probably... a lot.
A film can. Yeah. It was a film can full of coke, to get everybody through the show.
Because that's a lot of people. And I assume Jack Burns,
too. I was going to say, that's a lot of people, and one of them is Jack Burns.
Yeah, right. So, exactly, producing it with a satin jacket on.
Exactly, yeah, purple satin jacket.
Yeah.
George Carlin's old comedy partner. Where would they have discovered cocaine? It didn't take over the business. It took over half of our culture.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, wasn't relegated to show business. Yeah. Sports, everything.
Sports, Wall Street.
Yeah. Wall Street.
Yeah. And I don't know if there's any modern equivalent. I don't know if any drug today has just really just drastically etched its signature across culture the way cocaine did.
Probably not, because it stopped so many people dead, and it also was the fuel for so many people. I wasn't very cokey. I've always been a pothead.
Uh-huh. Here I go, the voice of the people, having done neither.
Yeah.
It must just... Is it easy to not do? I mean, because it's so addictive.
I never, especially when I started as a stand-up, I started at the Holy City Zoo in like 82, and upstairs was a coke den. And, a lot of comics, I don't want to name all their names because then I'm saying that they all did coke, but they all fucking did coke.
Yeah, they all did coke.
But I didn't really do it. I was more of a pothead. And the times I did do it and got up and did improv or stand-up, I was terrible.
Sure.
And so I found that marijuana or maybe a drink, I wasn't so terrible. I could still get high and perform and even more left brain and free associate and do all the things I like to do, which is bounce around with coke frozen. Frozen in one spot, boring topic forever and ever.
Uh-huh, and just everything is drilling down.
Yeah, it never made me feel free or whatever, loose. I want to feel loose on stage, but you want to have this is a horrible term, but you want to have equipoise on stage. You want to be completely in control, but able to handle equipoise.
Do tell.
You want to be keyed,
uh-huh,
but you don't want to be so keyed that you're running over things in case something happens in the
room. Now, I was making a horse analogy to the equipoise. I naturally thought it had something to do with horses.
Well, it does. I mean, I think it originates with a racehorse you want to have.
Right. He's keyed up, but he's not distracted.
Yeah. And like on stage, I feel like you don't want to be pressing so hard that you're blowing your own material.
No. And people don't understand
that. You want to be loose and delivering it.
And when you do go on stage, you do elevate beyond your normal behavior. It's an adrenaline thing. Even and you and I have been doing it the same amount of time. We have been doing it for forever. I go on stage. If you have a cold, you don't have a cold when you're on stage.
No, you don't feel bad when you're on stage.
No, you...
I just did a weekend in Houston coughing my head off until I got on stage.
Yeah, your adrenaline is pumping and you are fired up. The one time I was sick on stage, I was in Minneapolis, Minnesota, performing at a comedy club in the Mall of America.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like... It was basically a weekend doing comedy in Logan's Run. And there's literally, I was in a hotel room and I
got Roscoe Lee Brown's on your ass.
Exactly. I am bugs, kelp, plankton, sea greens, fried, and then comedy club food, fried cheese sticks, hilaria burgers. But I got a stomach flu.
Oh, yeah.
And literally, like, I just wanted fruit. Like, it was the only thing I could eat.
And fried food. Yeah, French fries.
You couldn't even get fruit. You could get raisinettes and wash the chocolate off them with a toothbrush.
Right.
Was the closest you would get to fruit. And you couldn't open the window. It was a hermetically sealed junk food, everything. And I was on stage literally drinking Pepto-Bismol out of a bottle.
Oh,
I was just like,
God,
this is the only way I'm going to get through this. It was awful.
I had this weird thing when I was a kid where I never slept more than maybe 2 hours a night. I was just, I had horrible insomnia.
Again, it's just the parallels are spooky.
You know, and anxiety, depression, whatever. The good thing about it is that it meant I was up all night watching these things.
Yeah.
And I was exposed to, by happenstance, The Young Ones and John Waters movies.
Yeah.
And New Wave Theater and seeing the Screamers play on Up All Night, on Night Flight. And, you know, the moment I always cite is when I saw The Damned on Young Ones. And I was maybe six and I went, this is the thing I like.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like an epiphany at that age where I hadn't seen it yet. And so TV became this escape, but also a way to experience things there's no way I could have experienced otherwise. I mean, my family is very blue collar, working class. My dad grew up in Brockton in South Boston, my mother grew up in Dorchester. And it was just not a thing that you would even know about.
It was not on their radar.
Not at
even
all.
A little. Weird thing about that just popped into my head was like, you know, 1979, 1980, everybody's favorite. It was Farrah Fawcett.
Yeah.
And Cheryl
Ladd.
Cheryl Teagues.
Oh, Cheryl Teagues.
I was really into Deborah Harry.
Yeah.
She just looked like she was not impressed with Farrah Fawcett at all.
She'd cut you. Have you heard her serial killer story?
Yes. She got a ride with
Ted Bundy.
Ted Bundy, yeah.
Yeah.
To this day, if you go on YouTube and watch them play Heart of Glass on Midnight Special, I know I sound like an old guy talking about Hedy Lamarr, but Deborah Harry singing Heart of Glass, she's hypnotic, and these people are going berserk, and she's ignoring them all.
Yeah.
And she's so cool and laid back. It's amazing.
It's like her character in Videodrome or something.
Yeah.
Like she's just perfect for that.
Yeah.
What I got out of TV, and you sounds like you did as well, and I think is different now in Lost for people who are younger than us, is that because you had to sort of earn these things and you anticipated them so much, you soaked them in. Mm-hmm. You tried to just memorize it because you never knew if you were going to be able to see it again, and they stick with you forever. And it was also your cultural capital. So I didn't like sports. Every year, instead of the Super Bowl, I watch Pump Up the Volume because I saw it in the theater. I went to an empty theater when it came out. And so I'm like, every year I have to watch this. In Boston, you literally hospitals close on Super Bowl. Like if they're like, I'm sorry, your mother can't be on life support.
It's just
everything's shut down.
On the rolling rally when the Sox won the World Series, they literally disinterred my aunt and held her skull up when the cars came by.
Yeah. I mean, it was ridiculous. it's
so insane.
It's hard to explain it to people who don't.
Matt Weinhold says this very well. What you're talking about, the things that we're into, it's our football.
Yeah.
And for those people, they have football. Peter and Bobby Farrelly from Rhode Island are, again, in the pantheon of super great people.
Yeah.
Peter had some soil from the mound from Game 7 when the Sox beat the Yankees. And he said, do you want it? And I said, honestly, it would
be
wasted on me, but my brother would go bananas.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, what's his address? My brother literally built a shrine to it. And it's so important to him. But it's like me. I have in that room a chunk of Ape City that I stole from Malibu Creek State Park, which used to be the Fox Ranch.
To
touch it. Yeah. It's real. It's palpable. Yeah.
To where we grew up, when you watch these things and they took you away from everything going around you, I call it going through the looking glass on the other side out
here. Totally.
You never get over it in the best possible way.
Yeah.
no matter how different people are as adults or their experiences as an adult, I find that of a certain generation, if you go back far enough, when there were fewer choices, we all watched the same stuff. If someone is has the opposite political leanings to you or whatever, you can go back and talk about Circus of the Stars or something.
Totally.
And they're going to book, you know, oh, I love that.
You all have
that experience. So that's nice too.
And that's so funny when you talk to these people, you know, I think Ted Cruz is a monster.
Absolutely.
But Ted Cruz believes 6% of the stuff he says. I know a lot of Republicans. They're all sane, lovely people.
Yeah.
And we're into the James Bond movie and the new Star Trek. We like all the same stuff. And it's just when you get down to the people separated.
It splits off a little bit for most people. But yeah, you can have this common ground, which is also nice. And TV, unlike movies, which are an event, is very intimate in a way because it's piped into your home and you experience it in your environment.
Yes.
So even though it's a mass cultural thing that everybody experiences, they all experience it slightly differently.
It was just recently New Year's and there was a whatever channel had the Twilight Zone marathon.
Yep.
I own every DVD and then I bought them high day. You know, like I have
as them, do
like,
I probably rarely put them on.
Never, never put them on.
Yeah.
But if they're on, I'm watching it and I'm emailing friends in New York and we're watching the same thing at the same time.
Yeah.
And it just makes it more special. It
absolutely. More and when there would be a marathon like that, you couldn't believe it. My favorite show that I wait once a week for, it's on all night. Part of that's probably the thrill of that as a kid.
Did you watch The Twilight Zone on Channel 38?
Yeah, TV 38.
Yeah. I used to go riding, especially during the summer. I would ride my bike around my hometown, which is just this little suburban town.
But you had the Mendon Drive-In nearby,
I had the
right?
Mendon. I would drive past the I didn't drive to go home and come home in time to watch Twilight Zone. Channel 38.
And the summer was great too. Because, I mean, I stayed up all night anyway. My parents really didn't know what I was doing.
I would stay up until about 5 a.m.
Yeah. I'd watch it all night.
Yeah.
And sometimes people come over my house and I'd be sitting and watching TV with the closed caption on, with headphones on, listening to an album and reading Fangoria. I need to learn all this stuff. You know, I need to soak it in.
My dad worked as a bartender for a chunk of my childhood. And when he would come home on Saturday night, from locking up the bar to getting home, he would walk in the door during the second musical performance of SNL.
Okay.
The two stories that I remember specifically is my brothers and I are all watching SNL. Devo is playing Satisfaction. Well, it was the second.
I think they played Girl You Want on the second.
Yeah, it was song. Girl You Want or no, Girl You Want is on album that has Whip It On.
Yes.
I don't know. Here's the point.
Yeah.
My dad comes in. It's Devo, yellow jumpsuit Devo, original vintage Devo.
Flower pot hat Devo.
Right. Yeah. My dad walks in, looks at the television and goes, what's this show? The goddamned asshole show? Walks through the room. That's what Saturday Night Live is still called in our house. So it's the goddamned asshole show. The second one, and everybody has been talking about this, and I've been looking at this lately because of the very tragic and sad passing of the great David Bowie.
Right.
That when he was on SNL with Klaus Nomi playing TVC15.
Yep.
And then boys keep swinging in that weird puppet body.
Yeah.
And I, for a long time, thought that that weird puppet body was something I imagined. He sang my TVC15 in a woman's Army Corps dress.
Yep.
With Klaus Nomi behind him. My brothers are out. I was watching it by myself. My dad comes in, hammered, leans over, gets about a half an inch from my face. And I'm probably 13. And he just goes, you like that queer, Dana?
Yeah. Yeah.
So intimidating.
It's not I like sports.
What am I watching?
Help me.
One good thing that I can say is that my dad used to think of himself as kind of a music aficionado.
Oh, wow.
And he would sit, and in hindsight, this was probably his escape from a horrible marriage. But he used to sit and make mixtapes that
my dad would say, you can escape?
Yeah, yeah. You know, for a moment.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. He would dig a tunnel and he killed. But he would make these mixtapes just for him that he would label, because he's also named Ken Reed, the Ken Reed Collection of Modern Music.
Nice.
And he would be like, there's Midnight Oil. Like, just for some weird thing.
Collection of modern music. How is that not your album?
I know it should be. It'll be like, here's Mexican Radio.
Your other album should be all Ken Reed's take on the modern scene.
Yeah.
In the late 60s, when the sitcoms came out, Cliff Nesteroff should come in now and talk. But the liner notes are always Nipsey Russell's take on the modern scene.
Yeah. Yeah. His view on the world. And I did get some cool music things, but my dad certainly was absolutely terrified that I was gay because I was a weird kid. I read comic books.
Same here.
Terrified.
Read read comic books, loved horror movies, had a lot of sex with dudes.
I had those dudes over the house all the time, but that was just so I could make money to get TV Guide. And my uncle was gay and is gay and lived in our in-law apartment downstairs.
His brother or your mother's
brother? My mother's brother, who's far more masculine than my dad, weirdly. And I had to break the news to my dad because he was going on some rant about like, oh, you know, it's not that I don't like, I just don't approve of what they do or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
And I was like, Dad, Paul's gay. And he goes, no, he isn't. I go, he lives downstairs with his boyfriend, and I'm 12. And he goes, no, he doesn't. He goes, that's just his buddy.
Oh,
and then I had to go, Dad, how many beds are down there? And it was like the ending of The Sixth Sense. He goes, well, there's only one. There's only one bed. And he just had this revelation. And later, he totally freaked. And I remember one time I used to get the Sears wish book and write down all the things I could never have.
And this is what we would do, the Sears wish book. I'm getting that.
Yep.
I'm getting that. Yeah, the Sears wish book.
You'd make a notebook.
That was a huge day when the Sears wish book showed up.
Yeah, and you could pummel someone with it. It was a phone book to fantasy.
You could beat someone to death with a wet Sears wish book. That would be like a great Carson line that he's never like. May a crazed consumerist beat your sister to death with a sopping Sears wish book. May a pregnant camel break its water over your wish book.
1 year I put down on my Christmas list, of which I got nothing ever on the list, but I put down silk sheets because they looked good. I'm maybe 8 or 9 years old. They just looked nice, you know?
You and fool.
My dad flipped out and he goes, who told you to put this on there? He thought some gay recruiter was like, all right, kid, come here. Put silk sheets down on this list.
Hey, kid. You ever really listened to Johnny Mathis?
I just want to slip into these. That was another piece of his like, oh, you're gay. And so after he kind of accepted that my uncle was gay and he's like, he's a good guy, he sat me down as maybe 15 and he goes, if you're gay, your mother and I will probably still love you. How I knew he was kind of being sincere, and I was like, I'm not gay. And he goes, oh, why don't you date a bunch of girls? That was his follow-up.
A great idea.
Yeah, I was like, I hadn't thought of it.
I moved to San Francisco in 1986 or 7. And I was 22, 23, the only member of my family to live more than a half a mile from the house where we grew up. And my dad's last words were, not goodbye, not good luck, not call when you get there. Because I was moving to San Francisco was, if you're thinking of coming home queer, don't come home.
Yeah.
Well, it's March 13th and starting today, I'm queer.
Well, I imagine your dad thinks it's like a zombie outbreak movie.
Yeah, it is.
He's been bit. We have to put him down before he turns.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If I move to Harlem, I might come home African-American.
This is what's best for him. He wouldn't want to live like that.
I'm not Zelig.
Yeah.
I'm not some sort of pansexual Zelig. Well, I would imagine that being on coke on stage is not, it's just too much of a good thing.
I've done it, but I didn't, I didn't think I was that funny.
Uh-huh.
And I think when you repeatedly do things and makes you not funny and it ruins your set and then it ruins your weekend, that eventually you kind of get bored.
And you know, you and I know a lot of people whose lives went right into a lake.
Well, the cost alone is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I always found that my problem was after doing it for a day or 2 days, because you end up usually doing it for a couple of days on a jag, is that I would get violently ill, that my body didn't really enjoy it. And then blues, really bad blues afterward. And then I thought, well, now I'm even more depressed than I normally am. So it didn't give me that James Wood thrill, like in The Boost. I couldn't go out and sell property with Sean Young or whatever. Like I never.
It's not like The Boost.
It gets you jacked and you want to talk all night and smoke and drink. And as Craig Ferguson said to me very truthfully years ago, the only reason a lot of people do coke is so they can drink more because it allows you the ability to get another bottle. And my joke was,
that's really brilliant.
Yeah, I got, because the coke dealer would go, oh, this coke's good and this coke's bad, and be like, let's dispense with the formalities. I've got an evening to ruin. I've got a gallon of vodka to get down. I want to be dragged face down the stairs by my friends and then barf in the Denny's bathroom and then call someone I met at a Yaz concert in 1994 at 4 in the morning. You know what I mean?
This is a Yola Tango.
Yeah, the
show.
Horrible shit that you do.
Yeah.
Coke is like, it exacerbates bad decision making. Alcohol, of course, impairs people completely.
Yeah.
And then it lowers their inhibitions. So now when you do add the coke to the mix of the alcohol, now your inhibitions are lowered, but you've got drive and pep. which is a terrible state to be in. You don't want to be uninhibited and focused.
Yeah, exactly. You're making bad decisions full throttle.
Yeah. Because you know what? We need more Coke. That's the first decision. Then we're going to call these dudes I know.
Yeah.
Then we're going to get in the car and we're going to drive to this guy's house. I'm like, no. All of these decisions are, oh, and then I know these chicks.
One of the reasons that I never did Coke was being around it as much as I was. I knew that it involved being in someone's house who you didn't know at 4 a.m.
Yeah.
That is not my jam.
No. And my joke was always, because W said he didn't remember doing Coke. And right. I said, if you did it, you remember it. My distinct recollection is it's not easy to obtain. First of all, you have to go to an asshole's house.
That
was always the part that I just, like, anyone I knew that was a Cokehead, that it was the people they had to buy it from were the most odious creeps in the entire universe.
Yes, well, we know a guy who booked comedy in San Francisco.
Yes.
Who's,
I can't pay you tonight, Dane.
Whose drug dealer thought that he should have been paying him more. And if I'm not mistaken, tied him up to a chair in his house and left him for a couple of days.
Yeah.
There was a guy in Boston who was dealing cocaine to a lot of comedians. And there was a semi-professional organization that liked to deal cocaine to the comedians.
Yeah.
And they had long tentacles and a deep cultural history and a couple of movies made about them, some of them directed by Francis Ford Coppola.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't like this other guy dealing to the comedians because they dealt to the comedians.
Right.
And so this guy apparently got this organization so irate that he got depressed, tied himself to a chair, and shot himself in the back of the head repeatedly.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And that takes a lot of doing.
That takes
strenuous.
A lot of doing.
Yeah.
Especially the second shot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Squeezing the second one off is a sheer act of will at that point. It lends a bad element. I mean, you know, I think we missed the era because, thank God, we came in during the comedy club era. We missed the era 15 years earlier than us where mobsters would come to your show and go, Dana, I love what you do. You're intelligent, you're smart, you're funny. I need to bring you to Vegas.
Yeah.
And you're going to get $12.50 a week. Right now you're making $3.
Right.
And then you sign the deal, and the $12.50 is for 25 years. You're never getting out of that deal, and you're never getting a raise. And then when you complain in 5 years, they go, look, when we found you, you weren't making any money.
Show you Joey Lewis's 8x10.
Yeah.
What's the problem?
You know, I mean, I remember, do you remember the actor Larry Luckinbill? Lawrence Luckinbill?
Yes, of course I do, yeah.
I met him.
He was Cyborg in Star Trek V, dude.
Yes, of course. I was going to say, to give you reference.
And he also played LBJ, I believe.
He played LBJ in a very good TV movie. He was also in William Friedkin's Boys in the Band, and he had a long career on
Big
Broadway.
New York actor. Yeah,
New York actor. And he was married to Lucy Arnaz and all that jazz. So I met him in the 80s, and he was a very New York actor-y type. And he told me stories about guys he knew that were club comics that got approached by mobsters and just roped in, man.
Yeah.
If you said no to them, you might get away with it. Like if you went at the very beginning, but his story was a guy gets taken out to a house outside of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, brandy, a fucking a rail, a cigar,
oh,
broads, and
awful.
Then, look, kid, we love you.
We want to buy you.
Uh-huh. And then, you know, I mean, I don't know if Paul Anka is an appropriate name, but there's lots of stars from music from the 50s that were completely tied up by the mob.
Yeah,
and obviously, you know, in the 40s as well.
Yeah.
I think we missed that and we're lucky.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Because we never got bought by that and never had to go do those gigs. I mean, you'd be tied up the rest of your life being an opening act for whoever.
Yes.
Or if they let you headline and you did get your money up, they were entitled to that other money.
They weren't big sharers.
We lived through another era of organized crime, which is the coke dealers that surrounded the comedy clubs in them.
Yeah, and it was, and there, you know, I was, you know, back in the day, I had been offered, do you want money or coke?
Yeah.
At the end of a week.
Oh, yeah. Well, famously into the East Bay promoter, who we all knew. And sometimes you'd finish
shall remain nameless under the thin, thin chance he's still alive.
Yeah.
But the man about whom Tom Kenny said, the only man alive who can bounce cash.
Yeah. And not only was he a cokehead, he was a degenerate sports bettor. So there was a variety of ways not to get paid. He could either come up to you at the end of the show and go, you know, my guy isn't here yet. I can't. And we're talking about, what, $75, $100, $150, maybe if you're headlining.
Dude, I drove to Hayward.
Right. It's a 45-minute over the bridge.
Pay me.
Yeah. And he'd go, look, the Niners lost tonight. They didn't cover the spread. And you'd be like,
God.
I'm not, what is this? Why are we playing in the gangland Chicago?
Steve Sciarippa, who was on The Sopranos,
yes.
as, what was his character's name in The Sopranos?
Oh, not Big Pussy.
Junior?
Yeah, Junior.
Junior.
And he was quite good on The Sopranos.
He was quite good on The Sopranos.
What did he run, Catch? I can't remember which club he ran one in Vegas.
Supposedly, on The Sopranos, he wore a fat suit.
Really?
Yeah. Supposedly, he wasn't
My voice went up 10 registers.
He ran the Improv at the Riviera Hotel in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
I worked at the Improv, and I was so happy when he got on The Sopranos because he so wanted to be in the mafia.
Yeah.
He lived to be in the mafia. And I performed at the Riviera Hotel in Las Vegas with a young, scrappy David Spade and John Mulroney.
Sure.
And not John Mulaney, John Mulroney.
I remember John Mulroney. Liar.
Exactly. So... And I hated working in Vegas.
Oh, it
was
terrible.
Awful.
Yeah.
And it was terrible.
You can't do anything conceptual.
You can't do anything. No, it's awful. You're the only performer they've seen whose tits are covered.
Yeah.
You know, where are you? I can't see your nipple.
Right, right.
So on the last show of the last night, I wore my underwear on the outside of my pants just because I was bored and I hated them. And Steve Shrubbe goes, "You're banned from the Riviera Hotel." you disrespect me.
Yeah.
You disrespect the Riviera Hotel. I was like, first, you can't ban me from a place I can't wait to leave.
Yeah.
As somebody once said, I forget who it was, online said, like, announcing that you're unfollowing someone on Twitter is like making a big stink about leaving a party you crashed.
Yeah. Right. Like, this free food, good night.
Yeah.
Didn't he tell one guy?
I want to leave. You don't understand, Steve.
Who was the headline?
I can't wait to leave that place. I want to go back to my century. I want to go back to my time.
My people. Who was the comic he told? You know, if you were supposed to do 20 and he did 22 or 24. And
every minute they're not out on the floor gambling costs us $350,000. Right. You know, like there's a figure attached to it.
But it's like every minute you're not on the floor, it costs us $350,000. We make $350,000 a minute.
Yeah.
Can I have an extra $10?
No.
No, we're broke.
No. Don't use so many towels.
And you
turn the air conditioning off when you leave.
When you work at the Riviera Hotel, you had to eat in the Riviera.
The employees lunch downstairs.
Which was awful. It's
buffet trays.
It was like where the guys from, it's like, it looked like the cafeteria on Emergency.
Yeah.
It's like you're down there with Gage and DeSoto.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. God, it was awful. God, it was awful.
I remember eating with the cast of Oba Oba downstairs, which was quite exhilarating because there was all tall Brazilian girls, right? Because Oba Oba was like a breasty show, you know, and then they all wore headdresses and match. Oh my God. I always hated playing Vegas.
That was the review. A breasty show.
A breasty show. There was one, was it Catch? I can't remember in Vegas. And I was there with Durst and Will and Mike. I mean, Devin, Mike, and Will. And
Will Durst and his wife, Deb.
And they had to, they asked you to write something over the stage. Like there was a wall of fame that you were supposed to write on and everybody written on it. And of course, the woman who ran the club, like they took me in as a pass. Like Will got me the gig, basically.
Right.
Like,
yeah,
it was so I could make $300 and open for them and I think it was 14 shows. You know what I mean? Like,
yes,
remember,
I do.
two a night.
Yeah.
On Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, like two a night.
The Chicago Improv was like that.
Right.
Three on Wednesday, five on Sunday.
Yeah. And you're like Sinatra. We're doing six shows at the Paramount, you know, and then a matinee, and then there's a movie and a short set.
You're like, Dean and Jerry.
Right. And then, so I died on my ass every single show, and I swore up a storm because I had nothing. And I remember she was all excited because they'd had someone there the week before that did so well that they were invited to go down and open for, who did Elvira?
Cassandra Peterson? Yeah,
no.
The Oak Ridge Boys.
Yeah. He did so well that after a couple sets, they asked him to come down, and he went over to the other showroom, and I was like, that's what can happen here. And I was like, I don't think it's going to happen for me.
I get to open for the Oak Ridge Boys.
So they wrote, you're not going to
open for the Oak Ridge Boys.
And I remember I wrote, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." And she came up and looked at it and went, "What was that about?" And I was like, well, the sense of despair that's welling up inside my soul with the thought of walking onto this stage on Thursday night in front of a bunch of really old people who don't know why they're here, that just wanted a break for an hour.
And they also say, she has no idea that somebody else also wrote that.
No. What Dante is not in her world. Yeah. She thought I thought it up.
You said
how come you're not that poetic on stage, you fruit?
We talk about these things like it was 100 years ago. It was 20 years ago.
It wasn't that long ago.
People forget when it was revealed that Rock Hudson was gay.
Yeah.
Time stopped.
Absolutely.
What?
He could have revealed he was a ghost the whole time and people would have been less shocked than hearing he was
gay. Totally. And even when Liberace started dropping hundreds of pounds.
Yeah.
They said he had a watermelon diet.
Yeah.
And that's why he lost all the weight.
Don't you miss the fucking watermelon rolls from Friendly's.
Watermelon rolls.
But,
I miss a goddamn Fribble is what I
got a wicked craving for a Fribble. It's hard for me and other people to wrap their heads around, like Paul Lynde and Liberace and, you know, all these people who are flamingly gay.
Yeah.
But people were like,
when you were a kid, a TV kid, you just thought that there was guys who wore ascots.
Yeah.
Or confirmed bachelor.
Exactly. And it's like,
confirmed bachelor, Paul Lynde.
Paul Lynde. Just looking for the right girl. But it was like, if someone asked him,
the Ernest Thesinger of the 70s, Paul Lynde. It was just not talked about.
Yeah.
Because I was the fifth of six and I was unsupervised during the week, you know, in fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth grade, I'd go to bed at 1 a.m.
Yeah.
I would watch the Tonight Show and then I'd watch the Tomorrow Show, or Letterman didn't start till I was until I was a senior. The code word for gay guys in the 70s was Bruce.
Yeah.
And Johnny Carson, a couple guys named Bruce.
Yeah.
He's going over to Roddy McDowell's house with his friend Bruce. And Bruce was such a gay name that when they made the television series, The Incredible Hulk, they changed Bruce Banner's name to David Banner because the fact that he would be named Bruce would mean he was gay.
Well,
it was such a big thing.
They compromised as Dr. David Bruce Banner because on the death of The Incredible Hulk on his grave, he has the whole thing on there. But Ken Johnson, who created the Hulk for TV and did V and these other shows, he claims that was not the reason why. He claims it was because he hated how comic booky the alliteration sounded.
Baloney.
Yeah, I'm sure. Sure it is. That Bruce Lee, totally gay.
Yeah,
like the toughest man of the 70s.
Yeah. Here's something I'm going to say only because it's true.
Okay.
Here's a great Bruce Lee story James Garner told me.
Excellent.
I was in the movie Remain Seated. I'm Just Like You, My Fellow Americans.
Yep.
I ended up spending three full shoot days, me, Jack Lemmon, and James Garner.
Of course.
I mean, we just sat around all day. Lovely people. James was trying to quit smoking, a little crabby, but he told us, now I was in Bruce Lee's dojo when he started out here, and it was me, George Pappard, Jimmy Coburn was in it. Bobby Conrad used to come. I love these people. He says, Bobby Conrad. So he goes, so Bruce, we were up at Bruce's house and he was sparring, and this guy he was sparring with, he's this black guy and he was like an Olympic champion. Like, he was good. And I don't know what he did, but he did something that Bruce didn't like, because Bruce looked at him and he said, you get one of those. That's all he said. Well, he must have did it again, because out of nowhere, Bruce put him down.
Yeah. It's for Jim Kelly or someone like
that. Yeah, but it's just like amazing. It's like
they're the closest.
Jim Rockford is telling me this story
and he
about
was
hanging
there.
Out with Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
And again, like, these guys, they're so classy. You read about these people that have one movie and they have an entourage and a toot, and they're just such pieces of shit. Jack Lemmon, I feel somebody come up behind me and he just squeezes my knee and he goes, hello, love.
I was in a movie with Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah, no, he would talk about Marilyn and he's talking about Marilyn Monroe, but like, he just came into the set.
Yeah.
I was sitting there and he goes, hello, love. Just a goddamn.
Because you're an actor, so you're in the same level as him.
Yeah, you're just there. Here's the From Hope Till Death story. I know I'm name dropping like it's going out of style, but I promise we're going to get into murder.
Yes, please. He told me you would murder me up here.
This was the one that I'd gone through the looking glass.
Yeah.
Watching the first Pee Wee Herman show on HBO in like LA in 1980, just pulsing like a heart.
And as different as you can possibly imagine from Massachusetts.
Yes. Yeah. Another planet. Years later, I live in Los Angeles. I'm married to my wife, who's an agent who knows everybody in town. And she knew and became friends with Paul Rubens. And through Sue, I became friends with Paul Rubens. And we went to the Groundlings to see a Groundlings stage show. And Mindy Sterling was in it, and Paul was in it, and all of these amazing, all these guys. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're all in it. And we see the show, and the show is great. And we're talking to Paul after, and we're walking out, and Paul just goes, goodbye, Dana. Goodbye, Sue. And we both just got like a chill. Like, did that just happen?
Yeah. I wore out four VHS tapes of that special from Delaney's Superette in Melrose.
Sure.
And I watched it over and over. Oh. And that aesthetic of that mid-century stuff, that it just spoke to me in a way that nothing else ever did.
It is never lost on me. It's such a strange thing to grow up and you look at something and it is like, it's a portal to a world that you want to live in.
Yeah.
And it shows you, no, there's a way out of here.
Yeah.
You can do this. You can do it. It's really important that people who don't want to be where they are, yeah. want to be something other than that, that they can see it and like, no, you can go there. You can do it.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't come out here until I was 30. And it was mostly because everyone's like, LA, blah, blah, blah. And then I came out here and I'm like, everything's familiar. I'm so comfortable. And I'm like, I'm in this. This is crazy. This is the best.
And I'm, and it is never lost on me.
Yeah.
That I every day drive on Mulholland Drive.
Yeah. It's just the road you drive to work on, but it's not.
It's not.
Yeah.
We were talking about, speaking of Mulholland Drive, the movie and the neighborhood in which Falcon Lane Recording is located, that every day the tales of that coin, the seamy underbelly of Los Angeles, every day taking the kids to school, I drive by the Wonderland Murder House.
And you tell your kids every day about
every
it.
Day.
You know those movies I show you?
But the Wonderland killings, located pretty much across the street from Wonderland Elementary School,
right.
which is not where my children go. It was the famous murder that involved John Holmes.
Yeah, Johnny Wadd.
Johnny Wadd, who is, for those of you who don't know, is basically who Mark Wahlberg is playing in Boogie Nights.
Right, and who Val Kilmer played in Wonderland, which is not a great movie.
Right,
that was the seediest thing possible. It was a porno star addicted to drugs murdering people. It was like what the Midwest thinks of Hollywood, you know? You'd have to be like, Dana, look out for those drug-crazed porno stars who are going to murder you out there.
When I would go to the comedy store in the late 80s, early 90s. It was at the height of the creep factor there.
Yeah.
Which is completely gone. The comedy store now is fantastic. But the inside is the same.
Yeah.
Bathrooms with all black fixtures.
Yeah.
Why would a bathroom be all in black? I don't know, but if you're going in there with a white powder, you wouldn't lose it. I know that.
For forensics reasons.
Yeah. And back in the late 90s, it would be like Sam Kennison with all of these porn stars of the era. There was a very porny feel to it. And Sam Kennison used to date porno stars. I think he dated Seika, was a one named porno star. You know, like Rudolph or Sammy.
Right. Sure.
But he would be like, look who I got. It's like, yeah, a woman that slept with 5,000 people. You should be here with Nancy Reagan. That would be impressive.
So John Holmes was a real piece of shit, I guess I could say.
But he had a cock with an elbow.
Yeah.
Like a big Milton Berle dong.
Big and not a handsome guy.
Yeah.
And he had...
No, he had a lurchy quality to him. He had a Ted Cassidy quality to him.
Yeah, with a mustache.
Yeah. When Ted Cassidy was in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, he kind of looked like John Holmes.
Yeah. And this was...
Acromegalic, I believe.
This was in the total mob porno world out here. It was still very, very cocaine. They were funding a lot of the stuff. It was a lot of money laundering going on.
They were making porn to launder the drug money.
Yeah. I always think it's so weird that we're like, look, prostitution's illegal, but if we film it, totally fine.
Yeah. Well, that's one of those weird. Yeah. That is one of those weird.
Really strange.
That is strange.
Really strange.
That was like the great George Carlin observation was like, selling is legal. Fucking is legal. How is selling fucking not legal?
Yeah. It's very strange. He became this huge 70s star when porno chic came in into the world, and mainstream audiences kind of knew him, and he developed a huge drug problem.
Uh-huh.
And he kind of fell on hard times and was stealing luggage from LAX to make a living and that sort of thing. And he was being the mascot for this guy. Last name was Nash. He was a big gangster out here, owned a lot of clubs.
Eddie Nash,
that's it. He had this house up in the hills, and he just used to have people come over and do drugs, and they'd have John Holmes come over and get his dick out. They thought it was a real funny
thing. You want to see it?
And so these drug addicts who were also looking to have a big score knew that Holmes had an inn in this mansion.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically told him, look, we're going to rob Nash, and all you have to do is leave the door open for us, and we'll give you a cut. So that's what Holmes did, because he wanted this money. And the guys went in and they robbed Nash, and Nash immediately knew that Holmes was involved. He was no doubt in his mind. So he went and got John Holmes, and he said, who are these guys that did this? And we're going to go find them. And they all lived in the house on Wonderland that I drove by.
Let me interject
here. Yes, absolutely.
With a story from the book, Scott Thorson, Liberace's lover. Scott Thorson called Liberace Libby, and Liberace called Scott Booba.
And he would go, if it's Libby, Libby, Libby on my label.
Put your hiney, hiney, hiney on my table. Scott Thorson was buying drugs at Eddie Nash's house.
Yeah.
And said that Nash called up this other guy, Gregory Dials, and ordered him to bring Johnny Wadd by the house while Scott was there. Dials found John Holmes on a street in Hollywood wearing a ring that had been stolen from Nash. So they bring him back up to Nash's house, and Nash, in front of Scott Thorson, directed Dials to beat Holmes and threatened to kill his family until Holmes told him who gave him the ring.
Right, right. And so he does, and they make him go to the Wonderland house where these guys live, and they basically go in the middle of the night and beat them all to death with a pipe while they're sleeping. And it's not proven, but the theory is that Holmes was made to beat one of these people to death because there's a Holmes handprint in blood above one of the beds. You couldn't confirm it.
Right.
And you couldn't confirm that he was made to do it or he, you know, he's a mess.
Yeah.
And so there was a trial, the trial of Johnny Wadd. It was this put on trial for murder, and he went to jail. I don't think he was convicted of murder, but he was in jail for something related to that. And it was kind of when that 70s porn chic died. There was
right.
a few things. It was like when Ginger Lynn went to prison for tax evasion, mm-hmm. when Tracy Lords dropped a dime on herself for being right. underage. And when he went to this jail, it was when it was over.
Back then, Ginger Lynn was going to marry Charlie Sheen.
Right.
And Martin Sheen put an end to it. And you have to think that this is back in the 80s.
Yeah.
So people forget that back in the early 80s, Charlie Sheen actually was a little weird.
And you
it's
know,
nice that he got out of it.
Respectable actor.
Yes, sir. May I help you?
Oh, I'd like two of those, please. Oh, and two bags of those peculiar white puffy material.
You mean our crunchy popcorn. Shall I wrap that for you, sir?
Oh, that's all right. My saucer's just outside.
They come from miles to enjoy our intermission.
He was born on Christmas Day in upstate New York. His mom was a housewife. His dad was a butcher. He was a bright, loud, talkative kid, and his parents encouraged him. He built a small stage in the basement and put on plays with the kids from the neighborhood, or without the kids from the neighborhood, as the case may be. His brother said he would entertain himself for hours by acting out dialogue from pulp magazines and movies he'd seen. He was famous as a little kid for asking adults questions and then, without waiting for their answers, just barreling over them with conversation. Once, on a two-hour car ride from his home in Binghamton, New York, to Syracuse, New York, this talkative tyke started chatting away in the backseat of the car. His family, wondering if he would ever catch on to the fact that they weren't participating in the conversation, remained silent. He never caught on and talked straight through for the entire trip. His brain was just that full of ideas. Rod Serling was Rod Serling, even as a kid. He was, as you might expect, an incredibly bright kid, a shiny penny, as one might say. He was addicted to radio shows, worked at his local radio station, and despite being accepted into college early, world events would interfere with his plans.
This will be the end of human civilization, and the world will belong to a planet of apes!
No, it was this.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
The beginning of World War I, Part 2. He enlisted in the Army the day after he graduated high school, and despite not meeting the height requirement, Serling topped off at only 5'4", he got accepted into the 511th Parachute Infantry Regiment. Serling got into the paratroopers by, if nothing else, force of will. He also used that to become a featherweight boxer. Rod Serling was transferred to the 511th's Demolition Platoon, nicknamed the Death Squad, for its high casualty rate, upwards of 50%. They were ordered to do a cleanup operation on Leyte Island in the Philippines, described by all involved as hell on earth. Serling saw death every day in the Philippines, at the hands of the enemy, the Allies, and even freak accidents. Witness, if you will, the sad case of Melvin Levy, Levy was delivering a comic monologue for the platoon as it rested under a palm tree when a food crate was dropped from a plane above. It struck Levy, taking his head off. Fans of The Twilight Zone will note that Serling set several of the series' more gripping war stories in the Philippines. Serling left the service with a Purple Heart, the Bronze Star, and the Philippine Liberation Medal. He returned home after the war and used the GI Bill and his disability benefits to attend Antioch College in Ohio. Serling trashed his knee in the war and would frequently suffer minor injuries throughout his life when it would give out and at odd times send him, on more than one occasion, tumbling down the stairs. At Antioch, he met Carolyn Louise Kramer, and they would soon marry and remain married for the rest of his life. At Antioch, Serling began writing scripts for radio plays. He got rejected. A lot. By everybody. Repeatedly. But he kept at it, and eventually made his first script sale, and then his second, and then his third. He got a job writing for a radio station in Cincinnati, and from there, a TV station in Cincinnati. He would go to school during the day and write scripts at night. He got an agent. They submitted scripts. They got rejected. Again and again and again. But he did not quit. In 1954, Rod Serling moved to New York, which, for him, was the case of the right person in the right place at the right time. It was the beginning of the golden age of television, the age of live, nationally televised drama, Playhouse 90 and Kraft Television Theater. One of those dramas, written in 1955, was called Patterns, the story of a big corporate boss running out of ideas and energy, and his inability to confront and accept the new corporate shark being groomed to take his place. Patterns features a classic Serling protagonist, an aging businessman more concerned with the well-being of his employees than he is the bottom line, being slowly ground down by the heartless, faceless corporate world of tomorrow.
Old man Ramsey could walk down a production line and call every man by his first name and get called by his first name in return.
I know that feeling, believe me.
He didn't need public relations experts. Honor was enough. Character.
Patterns aired and went through the roof and put Rod Serling on the map. The New York Times called it one of the high points in TV's evolution as a medium. He followed that up with Requiem for a Heavyweight for Playhouse 90, about the last days of a down-on-his-luck boxer. Another knockout. In the space of 3 years, Rod Serling went from veritable obscurity to one of the top playwrights in television. But something stuck in his craw. In those early days of television, shows had very specific, very powerful sponsors. It wasn't, say, Dragnet. It was Fatima Cigarettes Presents Dragnet. And goddamn it if the characters didn't smoke delicious Fatima cigarettes in every episode. Requiem for a Heavyweight was sponsored by Ronson Lighters. And so Serling had to cut the line, got a match? That wasn't such a big deal. But when it came to Serling's profound social conscience, it became a problem. Rod Serling was a strident social liberal, always on the lookout for the little guy, forever singing the praises of the forgotten man, caught in the unforgiving gears of the mindless machines of modernity. But big corporations didn't like to offend anyone or make any kind of wave. And Serling found himself repeatedly butting heads with his intransigent corporate overlords. Witness A Town Has Turned to Dust, the thinly veiled dramatization of the murder of Emmett Till, the 15-year-old African-American boy who was lynched in Mississippi in 1955 for the crime of looking at a white woman the wrong way. But under the hand of the censors, Serling's story of a young black child getting murdered in the contemporary South became the story of a young Mexican boy getting murdered in a southwestern town in the 1870s. In Serling's original draft, the town sheriff, who surrendered the boy to the angry mob, ended up committing suicide. But one of the show's sponsors was an insurance company, so they got rid of that because, well, suicide often complicates insurance claims. All references to the Ku Klux Klan were cut for fear, one must assume, of offending them. As Serling lamented, they went to work on that script like a room full of butchers going to work on a steer. He'd had enough, and as he told a young pre-60 Minutes Mike Wallace in an interview,
"Well, we hear a lot about censorship of the writer on TV. We've heard a good deal about it in your own case especially. Well, depending, of course, on the thematic treatment you're using, if you have the temerity to try to dramatize a theme that involves any particular social controversy currently extant, then you're in deep trouble.
So, Serling submitted a script called The Time Element as a pilot for his own series, over which he hoped he'd have a little bit more control. CBS took the scripts and produced it as a one-off for the Westinghouse Desilu Playhouse. The story concerned a man who has vivid recurring nightmares of the attack on Pearl Harbor. He can't shake the dreams. And eventually he goes to a psychiatrist. The first of many Twilight Zone twists? The patient in question actually died at Pearl Harbor. We're watching the psychiatrist story. The show was a hit, and CBS allowed Serling to go ahead and make a pilot for The Twilight Zone. And that is perfect TV business. One of the best writers in the business pitches a show. He writes a script to prove that the show will work. The script is made, and it's a hit. And so, based on this, the network agrees to let him make a pilot. Now that you've proven beyond a doubt that this can work three ways to Sunday, we will now let you go back to the beginning of the process again and officially ask us to let you try. Oh, if I haven't lived it myself, I wouldn't believe it. But after all the hoops were jumped, on October 2nd, 1959, a new television program premiered on CBS.
You are about to enter another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land of imagination. Next stop, The Twilight Zone.
Serling assembled a murderer's row of fantasy authors for his writing staff. Richard Matheson, who deserves and will get his own story on a future broadcast. Charles Beaumont, George Clayton Johnson, Earl Hamner. What is interesting is, people thought Serling had sold out.
Is pre-censorship, though, involved? Are you simply writing easy?
In this particular area, no, because we're dealing with a half-hour show, which cannot probe like a 90, which doesn't use scripts as vehicles of social criticism. These are strictly for entertainment.
These are potboilers.
Oh, no. I wouldn't call them potboilers at all. No, these are very adult, I think high-quality, half-hour, extremely polished films. But because they deal in the areas of fantasy and imagination and science fiction and all of those things, there's no opportunity to cop a plea or chop an axe or anything.
Well, you're not going to be able to cop a plea or chop an axe because you're going to be obviously working so hard on The Twilight Zone that, in essence, for the time being and for the foreseeable future, you've given up on writing anything important for television, right?
Yeah. Again, this is a semantic thing. Important for television? I don't know. If by important you mean I'm not going to try to delve into current social problems dramatically, you're quite right. I'm not.
He was wisely lying through his teeth. Serling wanted to write about race relations. He had an incredibly strong sense of moral justice and moral outrage. But if he wrote about, say, black people and white people, he would raise a red flag to the censors. They would come down on him and he would have to dilute and soften his message. But with The Twilight Zone, he could write about, say, people from Earth and people from Mars. And as a result, as they say, get the same message across in a more palatable form. It worked. It was brilliant. And the television landscape was changed irrevocably for the better. But of course, that's just the beginning of the story. For the rest, as they say, stay tuned. Now, let's say you can't wait for the next episode and you really need to know more about Rod Serling and The Twilight Zone. Right now. Well, I can suggest two great books. Serling, The Rise and Fall of Television's Last Angry Man by Gordon Sander. And Dimensions Beyond The Twilight Zone, a backstage tribute to television's groundbreaking series by Stuart Stanyard. That's the book, if you've ever gone to the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror at Disneyland/World/County, that they sell in the gift shop there. And full disclosure, I have an essay in that book, but I don't make no monies when you buy it. But where do you get these? Why, Amazon.com, of course. But how do you get there? It's easy. Go to danagould.com, click on our Amazon banner, and shop away. You get what you want, and the good folks at Amazon kick us back a couple shekels to keep the lights on here at Falcon's Lair Recording Studios. While in the shopping mood, you may want to tiptoe over to comedyfilmnerds.com for all of your Dana Gould Hour shopping needs. We have Bevel Aqua Heating and Air Conditioning t-shirts, Dana Gould Hour t-shirts, signed vinyl copies of Funhouse and Let Me Put My Thoughts in You, and at some point, maybe, somebody will print up that vinyl copy of I Know It's Wrong, hint, Dan, hint. Also, signed DVDs and CDs of everything. I have signed copies of everything, not even my own stuff. I've signed all of Elvis's albums and Roy Orbison's albums. Every Dixie Riddle cup. All available at store.comedyfilmnerds.com. Woo! I am pooped. Which reminds me.
It's coming. Here it comes. It's intermission time.
Welcome to Political Talk with two guys from Boston. A working man's look at the socio-political issues of our day. And now, Political Talk with two guys from Boston.
This is Political Talk with two guys from Boston.
I'm Robbie Sullivan.
I'm Johnny Condon. Oh, God, I'm tired.
Yeah.
I binged hunting Bigfoot last night.
The empty box shows.
Oh, God. They didn't find them.
No, isn't that weird?
Now, why do you call them empty box shows?
Because at the end, there's never anything in it. Like you.
God, that's brilliant.
Well, you keep thinking, you know, because my mother does this. She watches the hunting Hitlers and there's also like Mountain Men, the Bigfoot edition. She was absolutely fascinated that these people could be smart enough to find Bigfoot. And then she realizes at the end, oh, no, wait a minute. I was wrong. They didn't find him. But she was so sure if they have a show that's called that at the end, they must find him. Yeah. It's called that.
Hunting Hitler. Is like, wait a minute.
Wait, what?
The show that would be on is called The News.
It's so true. And the other thing is on that show, they're like, oh, well, we'll go to Spain right now because we figured it out. This is what we're going to find. And then you get there and they're like, oh, it's in some lady's backyard. That would be impolite. Was Hitler impolite? Maybe on a touch, a day.
The polite detective.
Yeah. You're going to be polite about Hitler? I don't think you're the right team.
That guy was covered in the victim's blood, but it was just not the time or the place.
Exactly. And it's always like, look at the dust. It's in the shape of a swastika. You know, it's never something real. It's always like some weird thing. And then they get, oh, this is exciting. And then it's like, next week on Honey. What? No, Ma. Don't worry. It's coming up. It's a marathon. Oh, God, no.
Ice Road Truckers, there would not be a show if there was another show called Barrel of Sand.
There's that American Pickers, and my mother
American Pickers.
My mother loves it.
What it's the like hell
they,
is American
they're going
Pickers?
Through people's like you know trash and buying it for money and saying, oh, I'll give you $60 for this. And the guy goes, no, $300. And he goes, oh, I couldn't pay over $70. But that's the show. And my mother's like,
for garbage?
It is. It's like, they're buying, you know, bikes from the turn of the century, whatever. But my mother's point originally was, I want to buy these things.
Well, that's...
I was thinking, Ma, you can't ride a bike. What do you want to buy it for?
And, you know, we've touched on something that has not been given its proper due.
Yeah.
And that is the timeless majesty of the concept of a box.
Yeah.
And people are fascinated by a box.
Yeah, I could have something in there.
Let's make a deal. The whole show is, here's a box.
Guess what might be in it?
Do you want to know what's inside it?
Yeah, what's your feeling about it?
All of the... And do you know the Big Mac? Do you know why the Big Mac comes in a box?
I don't.
And not wrapped in paper, which they could just as easily do.
Because it's
and
a
it's
gift.
Much less... People like things that come in a box.
Ah, that makes sense, actually.
And people are like, oh, it's a box.
Yeah.
Must be a much, much more important bird. and the best example of that is one of those empty box shows I used to watch was Storage Wars.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was like, here's a box. Do you want to know what's inside it? Yes.
Yeah, I'm dying to know.
I gotta
and
go
they give
to,
you a little glimpse.
But I gotta go to bed. No.
No. I saw a lamp and a piece of stereo equipment and also some fuzz.
There might be a golf club.
Yeah. And the guys who are bidding on that, too, they don't like one another.
Yeah, they don't like...
And that's a nice tension for a show that has nothing.
Yeah, and there's just... And, you know, I'm just waiting for the day. It's nothing but clown makeup and children's shoes. We got to tape this off.
My grandmother.
It's a bucket of hands.
No, it's my mother. She watches that show, too. The one with the chef, I don't even know his name, but he's, like, fixing people's restaurants.
Why is chef so angry?
I don't know, but that's what she said. She goes, every time, she says, oh, hold on 1 second. I'm watching the man who's helping fix the restaurants. He's very angry with this
group.
Very
angry.
Every time. He's very angry with this group. No, he's very angry with every group. Then restaurants are failing.
Why don't they call that show Asshole a Go-Go?
Invite someone in who's mad.
Why do people have to be dicks?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. You know, it's like, I always wonder, when you're in traffic in the morning, people cut you off to get ahead of you, yet nobody wants to get to work.
Yeah, but the guy who goes into the far right lane past everybody to jump in front of 10 people, I hate when that's me.
Do we have to, you know, we're at the intersection of, like, you know, Calm Ave and Harvard Ave, and you need to win.
Yeah, you got to win. It's like, really, you got 8 minutes?
Yeah, you win. All right. You win the light. Yeah. Go ahead. I guess I'll have to spend a little less time at work.
Yeah, and then there's the people that see someone else win, and they go into a road rage, and they're like, I'm going to win. Oh, how are you going to win? I'm going to smash into that guy from behind. Like, wait, that's not winning.
I do not understand it.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's a level of aggression that I do not have.
Yeah.
All I just want is solitude and Fritos, and I'm fine.
Well, you know, the Sox got David Price, so that'll bring a lot of people solitude. You know, they got a real pitcher this year. They got and they got Kimbrel, right? The close. I'm just saying, for some people, the whole world is revolved around something they have no control over. And they let their emotions get completely wildly available in the moments that's happening.
Here's my latest musing.
Yeah.
The greatest gift in the world would be if you could get back all the time you spent wondering what people who weren't thinking about you were thinking about you.
That's right. There's like that.
What thing. Are they doing now? Yeah.
Well, there's that thing where it's like when you're young, you think everybody's thinking about you. Later on in life, you realize, oh, nobody's thinking about me.
Oh, yeah.
And then you realize, oh, nobody's thinking about anyone but themselves.
Yeah, I remember I remember, like, for 2 years after I broke up with Sheila, I was like, what is she thinking about me? And now I realize at that moment, what she was probably thinking of is, like, I want more shoes.
And that's not really connected to you, is it?
Yeah, it's not at all.
No, Johnny, it's not.
That's most of a woman's thoughts, shoes. Which always made me... Why do little girls love mermaids? They're the only fictional character that has no need to buy shoes.
Maybe that's part of it. They could be, oh my God, my obsession could be over.
It's contradictory to the entire biological drive of a woman to buy shoes.
Think about it, though. You could not swim well with stilettos on.
No.
It wouldn't go well.
No.
Imagine a mermaid.
That's why Eddie Izzard did not qualify for the Olympics.
Is he a merman?
No, but he's in stilettos all the time. What makes his act special. He wears women's clothes.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's a genius. He's a dude in a dress.
I thought he was just weird.
He's a dude in a dress. Everybody shit themselves.
Yeah, my mother would say this about them. Now, why would he do that?
Why would he do that?
What kind of a gimmick does he think he's come on to?
Yeah. The other one is, and... All right.
I hear that a lot.
And? Yeah.
You're like in the middle of a story. Yeah, yeah. And?
That's a great one to throw at people. Go fuck yourself. And? They're out.
I got nothing left.
Yeah, that should be insult improv is a class that we should teach.
That's good.
Debase, humiliate, and add information.
And don't negate.
Don't negate, humiliate, and add information.
That's pretty good.
Go fuck yourself. You should fuck yourself in the pile of shit that you call your family.
High status, low status. I think and brings you right to the highest status.
Oh, we got to go. We got to go do that right now.
Yeah, I'm going to call my mother and pull that on and see if she even knows what I'm doing.
Here's the deal. If we can establish an improv school, we're that much closer to our stated goal of a traffic school.
We're going to do it.
Political Talk with Two Guys from Boston.
Hallelujah! It's the Dana Gould Hour. Listen all the time and give us all your money. That's all we ask.
Casper
is an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the average price. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly to the consumer. They make an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. Mattresses can often cost well over $1,500, but Casper mattresses cost just $500 for a twin-size mattress, only $950 for a king-sized mattress. Casper mattresses have just the right sink, just the right bounce, that's what she said. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. And all Casper mattresses are made right here in Merco. They have a risk-free trial and return policy. Try sleeping on a Casper for 100 days with free delivery and painless returns. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting Casper, CASPER.com/Dana, and using the promo code Dana.
Make sure you get yours and enjoy it now.
Settle back now, content, comfortable, well-fed, and ready for some fine entertainment. Is everybody happy? Then let's go. It's showtime.
You say something that I still quote, which made me laugh so hard. And the song, Are You Lonesome Tonight? I was going, someone once said all the world's a stage. Yeah, Shakespeare hillbilly.
You know, someone once said, Shakespeare.
Shakespeare said it.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, hillbilly guy.
Someone. Yeah, it was Shakespeare. Yeah. It was Shakespeare. Yeah. Now, Elvis, oddly, not a cokehead.
No. Heroin-based pharmaceuticals were his dilaudid.
Yeah, he was a pill guy. He was a pill dude, like my mom. Like my mom. Yeah.
Although your mother, I think, didn't have the access that he had.
You'd be surprised. What my mother does, just to digress, and I say this because I know she doesn't listen to the podcast. She doesn't know what a podcast is. She literally thinks that if you fly through a cloud, you can see people's computer stuff.
Okay.
When you say the cloud.
Yeah, the cloud.
The clouds, right. No, they're number.
Right.
So she has heart medication and blood pressure medication. And the doctor goes, you take this and you take this. And you don't take anything else. Because my mother will take also, supplements from the back of a witchcraft magazine. Right. Literally like 40 bottles.
Gene Dixon vitamins.
No, seriously. Yeah. And all my life has been like that.
Yes.
Just random and, random lunacy in periodic bursts. And literally like, well, I have my heart medication. I'm supposed to take that every day. What I do is I take 3 in one day. Then I don't take it for 3 days. But in those other days, I'll take my supplements that I got from the back of Hocus Pocus Quarterly.
Yeah.
My God. You're just running into a grave. In a dead sprint to a hole in the ground.
Yeah.
Give somebody a way to alter their reality and they just seize upon it.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know what it is about me that I can't go there.
Maybe it was, I always thought because your family was so, inebriated that you just reacted against that.
That's clearly.
My dad was a compulsive gambler and I don't gamble.
Well, there you go.
I mean, I can.
Yeah.
I have the ability to, right. But it's not something I find amusing.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up, I've said this before, everyone I knew was drunk. It wasn't like my parents drank.
Right.
My brothers, their friends.
Right.
My parents,
you
their
grew
friends,
up in it.
Our relatives. I was the only person I knew at times that wasn't drunk. Yeah. And so, I was just like, I don't want to do this. I'll just do it in the other person. But nothing like I never – like anytime I start to feel like I'm losing my grip on reality, like if I'll have 3 beers, like I'll go, whoa. But I don't want to not be at the steering wheel ever. And I also am moronic enough to think, here's my fear if I get stoned. I will start to think – this lasts forever and I'll never be normal again and then I'll panic.
You know? Well, that's irrational. But
yeah, well, I'm full of irrational. I'm chock full of irrational fears.
It lasts a couple of hours, and then you're tired, or you eat something.
Every time I get into an elevator and the door is shut, I think not only is this elevator going to get stuck, no one's going to rescue me. And they're going to find a skeleton.
Oh, okay. And no Godfather scenario. Yeah. There's not someone waiting with a sawed-off shotgun.
No one's going to care. You know, it's like for some reason, nobody's going to want to leave the building. And they're going to find a skeleton in 10 years.
Yeah.
And
you're going to be a Kliban cartoon.
Yeah, exactly. It's not good. It's not. You don't want to be in my head ever.
You convinced me of that. But I'd already felt that before.
This is not news. It is a very strange. It's a very, very weird thing. And I know I'm very, very, very far removed from the mainstream.
It's not for you, and you know that about yourself. That's the good thing. There's a lot of people who don't know that about themselves. You know what I mean? And they do whatever they do, and it's not good for them, and it doesn't work out, and they carry on doing it.
And it's amazing. You know, as I was at the Melrose Improv last night, and I walked up, and this really drunken guy says, "Hey, guy, come in." And I was like, "Well, if you pay." And I just walked past him in the club. And the doorman was like, "You can't come back in, buddy. You can't go." Like, he was drunk and they threw him out. And I'm like, it's 2016.
Yeah.
And this guy's literally standing out on the sidewalk, fucking plowed.
Yeah.
And I'm like, who still does that?
Lots of
the
people.
The answer, everybody.
Yeah, lots of people.
Everybody.
Go to any, you know, college town on the main drag on a Saturday night.
I can see a kid in college. This is a grown man.
There's whole countries that everybody's doing. No, Ireland,
Scotland,
no,
it's completely me.
Norway,
it's Australia. Me. It's me. It's not them. It's me.
Yeah. My little rule is I'll drink after the show, but I don't leave the club.
Uh-huh.
Like when they throw us out of the club, I go home.
Yeah.
And I don't, because in the old days when I was, you know, young and swinging, first of all, I've always had a wife or a girlfriend. I've been my wife for 1,000 years. So I don't go out and run around because I have no interest in it.
That's amazing.
And that's one of the main impetus most guys have after the show is let's go trolling. And it's like I have. Oh, no.
You and Jennifer, when did you guys start dating?
If I say she's going to kill me,
no,
so
your
a long
ages,
time
your
ago,
ages, your ages.
I'm not telling her age on the
No. How old were you guys when you started dating?
I was 25, yeah.
Yeah. So you're like she was like what your third or fourth big relationship in your life or
she was only 11 when I met her and she was so sweet. I think I'd had two other major girlfriends.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were kids and so I never I was always attached, so chasing girls was not something.
And Jennifer's your lovely bride.
Yeah.
Jennifer, lovely, great person.
Yeah, she's fabulous.
Super
and smart.
Great.
And what, you know, so I never really did that. And so at the when I was in my 20s, I would go out with the staff or we'd go to a bar or whatever.
Yeah.
And then I always realized that's when the poor decisions get made. I'm going to do coke or I'm going to do more drinking or I'm going to talk to this idiot. And then you realize you can obviate all that by not doing it.
And you know what? You know
it doesn't make me a better person. I just get drunk at the club and then I go back to the room
with
the other comics or maybe a couple bar staff that I like. But I'm not going out to socialize with the world.
And you know what
wrong.
I think? You know what? There's an element of that that I just realized now that you say it. And I just, you know, when you put yourself in that position, especially touring comedians, touring musicians, you don't want to go home and be alone.
Right.
So what can I do to not...
To stave that off till 4:30.
What can I do to not... To not be alone.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big part of it.
It really is. Yeah. Fortunately, I've never really minded being alone. It doesn't bother me at all.
Especially comedians, even much more so than in a band. It's hard to tell people, like, it's such a solid, like, I'm a writer and a comedian.
Right.
I'm never with people.
No.
It's a terrible downside to my life. And it, like, when I do have a problem or something, I have so much time.
To obsess
to
over
just
it
stew,
instead of talk to your friends?
Yeah, stew and
brood. Oh,
and not just get distracted by life and by work. And like, you're just home. And
right. Overwhelmed by the
Whatever is your issue. Yeah. And it's really... awful.
Yeah. And the reason I like the solitude of being a comic is I can read and I can watch things on the computer that I like to watch, like what your documentaries that no human is going to share with me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I can watch my own thing and not have to explain to everybody why I'm watching an Alexander the Great documentary at 1 a.m.
Right.
John Holmes, it's never been confirmed, but he very well could have murdered those people or was at least involved in it.
There are celebrities that die, but there's a weird culture of famous people who have killed people.
Yeah.
The most famous, First Lady Laura Bush.
Yeah.
She crashed into another car when she ran a stop sign and killed the driver who was a classmate of hers.
Yeah.
How did she not go to jail for that?
Because she was Texas from money? Blue Bloods. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the thing where you just, you make a mistake.
Right.
And meanwhile, a kid has, pot on him and he's in jail for
400 years.
Yeah.
William S. Burroughs killed his common-law wife.
Shot her, right?
John Vollmer. Yeah. They were, I believe they were playing
William Tell.
William Tell. Yeah. Boxing promoter Don King killed two different people in his younger days when he led a gambling ring in Cleveland, Ohio. He shot one and the other one he stomped to death.
Yeah, that's not a mistake. Like, if you're stomping someone to death, you try.
I was trying to get gum off my shoe.
Right. He was choking. I was trying to get it out of his goddamn throat.
Robert Blake.
Yeah.
So here's the theory of the weirdness of Robert Blake. The most famous celebrity murderer, although he was acquitted, is O.J. Simpson. People, I'm going to just say it. I think he did it.
Have you read If I Did It?
No, I have not read If I Did It.
I have a PDF of it. It is chilling. So he wrote a book called If I Did It that was...
Just say you did it.
Yeah. And it was supposed to be like, look, I didn't do it, but if I did, here's what happened. That was the book. And it was supposed to come out.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And this book, it was printed and ready to go and they destroyed the copies. But it's crazy. And I worked at a radio station at the time and we would get advanced copies of stuff. So I have a
PDF. At FNX?
I worked at FNX. Yeah. He basically goes through all the details of how he murdered them.
Right.
And the weird thing is he invents an imaginary friend. And so
please tell me its name is Snuffleupagus.
It's called Snuffleupagus. It's he basically took the script to Drop Dead Fred. And he calls himself Phoebe Cates.
nice Rick Mayall pull.
Yeah. But he basically blames it all on this imaginary friend who is with him. So he says, if I did it, I was certainly there. I watched them get murdered, but I didn't do it. This other guy did it. And it's clearly a dissociative personality that he has. And now that we know all this stuff about these brain injuries that these football players have where they go insane. They used to call it roid rage, but it's really from repeated traumatic brain injuries.
Right.
You have dissociative disorder. You have fits of rage, violence. It lines up perfectly. He may believe he didn't do it because when you read it, he's like, look, I was there. I saw it happen, but this other guy did it. I forget the name of the guy, but he's like, my buddy Billy.
This is what I have been led to understand. And if I am incorrect in this and you know it, email me at show@danagould.com and we will unpack this in a further episode. But from what I am led to understand, David Lynch was obsessed with the OJ trial.
Mm-hmm.
And he believed that OJ Simpson killed Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. And then because of his dissociative disorder, could not reconcile the reality with his own self-image.
Right.
That he literally became a different person. That after he was arrested or after the murder, that he literally became a different person that didn't do it.
Right.
And that is how he rationalized and that's how he was able to behave the way he did because to him, he did not do it. That is the origin of the film Lost Highway, where Bill Pullman kills his wife, cannot reconcile it, and becomes Balthazar Getty.
Right.
To allow himself the reality that he didn't kill his wife.
Right.
In the movie Lost Highway, there is a mysterious figure that visits him from the ether that is basically the motivation for this change. And it is played by Robert Blake.
Yeah.
Who then later killed his wife.
Yeah.
And life imitating art.
David Lynch is one of those people that I always kind of think of him as a non-violent version of the main character in The Killer Inside Me.
Uh-huh.
In that he's like, oh, shucks, I don't know nothing. Mm-hmm. But he's so...
He gets it, you know?
And when you read If I Did It, it's basically Lost Highway. It's freaky how close it is to that movie. Speaking of Robert Blake, while I was out here this time, I always try
to kill somebody.
I try to kill like two or three people.
Transients.
As much as possible, just to feel what it's like to have power. And I mean, I'm a huge fan of Manhunter. It's maybe my favorite movie. But I had Jill Sholin on my podcast, and she's an actress and was in Popcorn, one of my favorite movies.
Right.
And she was on the show Helltown with Robert Blake, where he played an action priest.
Right.
He was like a vigilante priest in the 80s. And she said,
Aren't they all?
Yeah, she was like, we were friends. We'd go to the Tellos and have lunch at the table that he killed the wife at. His cat had kittens. He gave me my kitten. And she sees him every now and then at this Whole Foods near her house.
I was just going to say, I see him at the Whole Foods. Yeah.
And she says,
and it's spooky
yeah.
when you see him because there's a vibe about a guy that's killed somebody.
Absolutely. And she feels legitimately bad that she ignores him when she sees him. She's like, I don't know what to say. And I'm like, it's not like someone you went to high school with who killed somebody and you happen to find out. He knows you know. There's no way he doesn't lets know
her,
you know.
He lets her...
Lets her ignore him. And she's like, I've seen him 12, 13, 14 times and I ignore him. And it's not like just someone at work. Like, we were friends.
Yeah.
It's amazing to hear all these stories about athletes, especially who have the CET and murder their whole family. Like that wrestler whose name I can't remember, he strangled his kids and his wife and killed himself. He went completely nuts. WWF wrestler. It'd been about 10 years ago. I hear him often quoted in roast battles when people try to say the most offensive thing they can think of and their only sphere of reference is wrestling. Chris Benoit.
CTE.
Yep.
Chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
Yes.
Formerly believed to just be among boxers, but it's a progressive degenerative disease which affects the brain and people who have suffered repeated concussive and traumatic brain injuries. Yeah. A lot of times after like football season that a lot of these guys have to chill out for like a week before they go back to their families.
Yeah.
Because they're so jacked up. And
yeah. And they also don't, they won't remember their friends' names and all this stuff. And they used to just call them like, he's got wet brain or,
wet brain. Yeah. Or what would they call it? Punch drunk.
Yeah. But they're using these guys up. And when you look at all the guys that have murdered people who have this in common, it's pretty damning.
It tracks, as they would say.
Yeah.
Completely tracks.
Yeah. And the Chris Benoit thing, he's been completely erased from WWF history.
What was his wrestling name?
I think it was Chris Benoit.
Murdering Chris
Killer
Benoit.
Killer Benoit. Yeah. It was Baby Killer Benoit, weirdly. But yeah, he killed his kids, everyone. He murdered his whole family.
As Jim Thompson writes in The Killer Inside Me, the sickness won again.
Yeah. And
I remember that quote from that book. I hit her in the waist and she folded in half like a hinge.
Yeah.
The sickness had won again.
That book is so brutal.
Yeah.
And it's hard to believe it was written in like 1944.
I know. Yeah.
I went through a real bad time in my early 20s where I was reading Hubert Selby and Jim Thompson books way too much. Just like,
I don't think you can read them too much.
Well, it's a hole you can't have trouble getting out of.
Yeah. Have you read Brainquake by Sam Fuller?
No, but I love Worcester's own Sam Fuller.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You read his autobiography?
No.
Oh my God. He killed Nazis in World War II. Like,
right.
With his bare hand. Like, right. He's this tough Jewish angry guy.
Yeah.
And he was one of the first crime reporters in the country. He did the crime beat in Worcester and he would do like this real hard boiled crime writing and then started directing these movies like Shock Treatment.
Yeah.
These just
yeah.
really grim movies. Have you ever seen Return to Salem's Lot where he acts?
Yes, I have. I have.
I seen killed that Nazi bastard. He kills Tara Reid. That sounds like a dream you'd have. Like, yeah. So Tara Reid's a vampire and then Sam Fuller kills her.
Yeah. This is the strangest dream. When you talk about how far removed you get pulled from the mainstream of society, like I go on Netflix and there's like, I'm only interested in like 0.0001%.
Uh-huh. The new releases, I go by like this.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, where are the Hitler documentaries?
Right.
Where
you know the three things you want to see.
That's exactly right.
But all the new releases and all the big industrial movies, I'm always like, and when people get excited about them, like, there's a new superhero movie, I'm always like, hooray.
Yeah. But
there's always a new superhero movie.
And also, it's the same. Don't you only need to see the one?
Right. Well, my line is, I would love this, that the superhero movies and the comic book movies more, if it didn't always end with them fist fighting each other for supremacy. Like, they've got all these superpowers and they got another planet and all this jazz. And then at the end, they punch each other a bunch and then one's dead and that's it. And you're like, I sat through 2.5 hours of noise so that someone could punch someone.
What's also interesting in
where's the sci-fi?
In all of those movies and even stuff like, did you watch Sense8?
I did not.
It was the Wachowski project.
Right.
It was a very fascinating science fiction series on Netflix. And it was a really wonderful concept that these 8 people are born with this common thing and that they can literally like go into each other's bodies.
Oh.
And they're connected. And they're all over the world.
Yeah.
And it's really well done and it's really brilliant. They did an amazing job. But so you have this amazing premise, really well executed. And over the course of the season, it's all about them resolving their own revenge scenario.
Ah.
It's like it goes down to the most basic
concept. It was like, I'm going to get that guy.
Yeah.
I'm going to get that guy back. And it was like this amazing high concept. And then it goes down to that. And that is, but that's a fascinating thing about stories. Like, you'll start off with the most highfalutin concept, but it always comes back to a very basic story of, I'm going to fucking get you.
Right. Well, I mean, look at the Matrix trilogy. The first one ends definitively when he flies out of the phone box into the sky, and he has the power to fly now from his own control of his set mind. That's the end of the movie. He phones the machine and tells the machine, I've overthrown you.
Yeah.
There's a new sheriff. Watch me work.
Yeah.
And eventually you realize. Then there's a second movie where there's a lot of fighting. Uh-huh. And then there's a third movie where there's more fighting. And they keep punching each other.
Yeah, they
and
keep then just punching each other.
And then they punch faster. And then they run up a wall and punch each other. And you're like, well, the second and third movies, especially when they had like the, if the future is living in a cave having Burning Man all the time, and I have to be a white guy wearing dreadlocks, I don't want to be in that future. I like the sophisticated bad guys future where they all wore chic clothes and that beautiful Italian actress was there. Which she's in the second or third one. What's her name? And the sexy guy with the cheekbones.
I only saw the first one.
The first one's great, right? Yeah. Because it's that great high concept sci-fi premise.
Yeah.
What if we didn't understand that our reality was being controlled by machines that built the reality to control us that we built initially? And then
it's a great idea.
When the movie came out at the time, I remember people had a hard time grasping it. They're like, but reality's a construct. Reality is a construct, you guys.
Yeah.
We're all agreeing that we're in reality right now. And it's very easy, especially if you spend time by yourself, to see the cracks in that. And
totally. The social contract can just fall out apart.
Right. You know, and like, so I think there's a lot of movies that start probably with, and the Wachowskis, you know, that's their tendency. They want to show people fighting. Like the Iron Man movies and stuff, you know, I don't know. I remember years ago I said something ratty about one of the Spider-Man movies, and Paul Tompkins, I didn't like it. And I said, Paul, I really don't like a lot of stuff everybody likes. And he went, Greg, that must fit you like an old overcoat. It's like, I'm a contrarian. What can I tell you? It's not that I hate everything everyone likes. It's just that I'm not here to support that. I don't feel like that's that important.
There's things that, like, I think the last, it's so funny. I think the last two movies that I saw was Star Wars and James Bond.
Right.
And I knew both.
But you've been watching this since you were a child.
And I knew what was going to happen in both movies before I sat down. And I find them completely entertaining. Like, yep, that did it. Good. Fine.
Well, you want the ride.
Yeah.
You know, it's a ride. What was the one with them where M is his mother and Star? I don't know. It was
Skyfall.
Skyfall. Yeah. I really enjoyed that. We watched it on like Christmas a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And Jennifer was like, oh, look. And then they brought the Aston Martin out. And I was like, oh, the Aston Martin.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah.
Like, I remember with having the matchbox of the Aston Martin.
The ending is Home Alone.
Right.
I don't have time. Well, that's the one thing the first thing that goes when you have children is going to see bad movies, ironically.
Yeah. Because there's simply no time.
This is
going to
suck.
Yeah.
Let's all go.
Yeah.
No.
Don't have that 3 hours.
I don't have that time anymore.
No. I used to go to the movies in the old days when there wasn't a like massive video in your room and you didn't have a computer you could call anything in the world up on.
Mm-hmm.
We used to go to the movies, right? You'd be on the road, you'd go to the Cineplex and go see maybe sometimes two movies in a day.
Oh, you go to movies every day.
And then come back and go to do your show. But movies were what you did because it's a solitary. You can go with yourself or you can go with the other comic.
And I remember like from those years where I was always on the road in the like 87 to 98.
Yeah.
Like I saw everything.
Every movie.
Yeah.
Every movie.
Like, you know, if I'm on Doug Loves Movies, if we're in that era.
Right. You smoke it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you get out of that. I'm like, oh, I had kids then.
When he says there's a movie from 2007 and it's a sci-fi classic, I don't know.
Yeah,
what
me
movie.
Neither.
I said, could we conduct this in black and white? Then I have a fighting chance.
I just go, my daughter was five. I didn't see that movie. I saw the Carrot movie or whatever.
Right. You saw, you watched the Wiggles.
Yeah, exactly. I saw every Aardman animation movie.
Yeah, that does go away, I suppose, when you have kids. But I still don't want, I mean, I'll catch up for them on planes. Like, I go to England two or three times a year. You have 12 hours to watch crappy. I watched Wolf of Wall Street the whole way through. I tried to walk out of the plane, but I still watched the whole thing. But I thought, well, this will kill a few hours.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? At that point, you're just like, okay, fine, you know. And then you fall asleep for half an hour and you wake up and you're like, I didn't really miss that much.
No, not if it's a Leonardo DiCaprio movie. You yelled at something.
There's comics. There's people who tweet, like, such and such big blockbusters coming out. I can't wait. And I'm like,
Really?
Are you nine?
Yeah, I know.
Like, it's going to come out anyway. It's in a big machine, a big show business machine that doesn't care whether you like it or it's good. And there's no quality control. Yeah. And you can smell the meetings. When you watch scenes, you can smell meetings.
They know within $10,000 what it's going to make before it opens
pretty
up.
Much. Yeah. Otherwise, they wouldn't have made it.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, okay. Can we watch something with a plot or, like, you know, I don't know, characters? Characters are good.
Well, that is...
Dialogue's nice.
And, you know, you do... it is funny, like, to go back to that, like, the late 70s, early 80s, where it was also the end of that era of Hollywood movies where the big studios were making these amazing films that would not be a major release today.
Oh, no.
And everyone was coked out of their skull.
Yeah, they were. A lot of stuff got green-lighted. Well, the executives were coked up.
Yeah,
that's what
I mean.
Made, like, the difference.
Just...
The executives were like Bob Evans coked up. So.
Yeah.
Or what's his name? Don Simpson. You know, that kind of coked up.
Yeah, just professionally coked up.
We're going to do a race car movie.
Yeah.
I love it. We're all going to get jackets.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're going to do a submarine movie. We're all going to get those hats.
Right. And then they'd make a big coked up blockbuster. And okay.
That's crazy.
No, there was a lot more. And I mean, I don't believe that the past was better, but I think that this, I love 70s movies because they're so adventuresome and weird. And you had the added element of all of a sudden we had to have black people and Asian people. And all of a sudden there was all these different genres that got chucked into it. It's also the death of regular movies, because Star Wars did so well that everybody thought they could make a crappy sci-fi movie too. And just that would be as big and blown up.
Everybody wanted to make Galaxina.
Yeah. Yes.
Or what was the movie with Dorothy Stratton?
Wasn't that Galaxina? No.
I think that was Galaxina.
And she's a robot, and you can have sex with her, I think.
And Star 80 was the movie about her.
Yes.
Right.
There was one with Melanie Griffith, too, where she was a robot, I think. There's so many crappy. There was one.
They're
with
all robots.
Star Quest and Laser Blast.
Well, I remember Laser Blast. Yeah.
I saw them all in the drive-in. And Godzilla versus Mecha Godzilla, which is one of the last great crappy Godzilla movies.
Yes, true. Oh, Mecha Godzilla.
I know. And you get nostalgic for it.
But it is interesting because you talk about that and, like, when like, in terms of, like, the movies that you like, as you said, like, I watched these when I was a kid. You have a deep love for these movies that you saw from, you know, 13 to 21. You know, 13 to 25. Music is the same thing.
Oh, absolutely.
It goes onto your hard drive when you first are exposed to it. And you stay aware of new things, but nothing ever replaces that stuff.
Oh, no.
I just find that it goes onto your hard drive, it stays there, and that's it.
The advantage of that, though, is I thought I would be the boring old guy saying how everything was great before, which I try not to be. But on the other hand, when I do my podcast and kids come to the show, which they do, and I get lots of people in their 20s, if I start talking about 70s music, they want to know. They legitimately want to know.
Really?
They haven't always been exposed to all of it, or they don't know. I mean, obviously, you can't get away from classic rock. I go into a place where they're playing classic rock, and it's literally our playlist from high school.
Yeah.
And you're like, who wants this? This is 40 years old.
Yeah, Deep Purple.
Who wants this, you know? But they don't know who the New York Dolls are, you know what I mean? Or Iggy Pop. They don't know early Iggy Pop or something like that. And if I talk about that, or when Gil Scott-Heron died, I play Gil Scott-Heron, and, like, they just don't know who he is.
Right. And it's amazing that these people were so huge and so influential. Yeah. And it goes to that bigger lesson of you... If you're an artist, you cannot live your life focused on your art in the hopes that that will make you immortal.
Yeah.
You had better enjoy what you're doing while you're alive. Because when you're done, and it's over, and it's gone. You know, giant people that were huge. We also recently lost Lemmy from Motorhead. I have a weird Lemmy story. There used to be a public access television show out in L.A. called Colin's Sleazy Friends.
Yeah, you'd have porn stars on a lot and stuff.
Yes, right? And comedians like, let me just pull a name out of thin air. Mine. His name is Colin Malone. He's a really nice guy, and he worked at the 2020 video on Ventura in Laurel Canyon, which is now a pizza place or something. And he would saw me. He's like, do you want to do the show? I was like, yeah, okay. So it's me and Lemmy and some porn stars.
Yeah.
And they're doing what porn stars do. They're not fucking, but like these two
girls. Pay attention to me.
Yeah, they get their shirt up and their boobs are out. And I was sitting next to Lemmy in a beanbag chair. And the girls were like doing something with a toy. It was something really like down market.
It's like a bachelor party.
Yeah, it was down market. Yeah. And I literally, this is God's truth. I looked up to Lenny and I said, I had this dream before, but there was a hobbit in it. And without missing a beat, he went, I didn't have beanbag chairs in Middle Earth. That's my Lemmy story.
I used to have a cable access show when I was 12 and Melrose like comic books, right? And I have Neil Gaiman on and Frank Miller and these people because no one cared about them.
Yeah.
But
when you were 12.
Yeah, when I was 12, I was very bored and I got endlessly made fun of it at school. But when I was
those fools.
I know. When I was taking classes there, they had a guy come in and teach us the difference between hardcore and softcore porn. Because on cable access, you can show softcore porn. And I'm 12 years old and this guy comes in and he goes, can you show an erect penis? No. Can you show a penis? Yes.
Oh my
Can
Lord.
You show a vagina? Yes. Can things go inside it? No.
Wow.
It was literally like that. And I'm like,
it should be on a laminated card.
Yes. Like you're shooting and like, hold on, let me
Why
check
is this laminated? You'll find out.
Back up. We can't do this. But it was the craziest thing. So I always remember that when cable access, like those two girls had a limit they could do.
That's amazing. That was one of those things that like I'll be driving around and I'll, oh, that happened. That was real.
It was weird too when Bowie and Lemmy died at the same time. And I like Motorhead good enough, yeah. You know, whatever. They're fine. There was that famous quote that Motorhead wrote one great song 150 times, and which is true, you know.
So did the Doors.
Yeah. But people were like, oh man, Lemmy and Bowie. And I'm like, No. Bowie changed the world.
Somebody said the smartest thing about David Bowie to me, and I don't, Jesus Christ, Jeff, it might have been you. That Bowie was the gay guy that the classic rock guys didn't have a problem with.
Yeah.
The classic rock, was that you, wasn't it? Yeah, it was.
Skinner was cool with him.
Yeah. And it was like the DJs and the culture, like our Jeff and Miley, our meathead friends, but Bowie was all right. Bowie was great. And he made that, broke down the doors. He made that okay. Like, yeah, all right. He's gay, but yeah, like, and then Freddie Mercury.
Yeah.
And, you know, they all came later, but Bowie's like, yeah, whatever.
He paved the way for Kiss.
He was above it. He was above it.
He transcended hating him for whatever
Whoever reason. He was fucking was irrelevant.
Yeah.
It was him.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just really, and it was a really, really brilliant observation, and it stuck with me. It's like, yeah, he was gay, and it was like, but it was okay. I was like, yeah, it was Bowie. Yeah, and you just knew by looking at him that he was not really from this planet, and that you had no right to judge him.
Yeah, you just couldn't. You're like, I'm not even gonna try.
Yeah, that's what it was like. Yeah. I was like, yeah, no, he can do what he wants. I can't. Talent wise, I don't think you can compare Lemmy to Bowie.
No,
but Lemmy was
iconic,
and he was 100% Lemmy.
Yeah,
he did one thing really well. Yeah. He was Lemmy.
There's a really interesting rule in England, the entertainment industry over there, and it's less like this now, but it's very bureaucracy. Like Brazil, movie Brazil is pretty accurate about everything. And so there's a rule that if, at least when Top of the Pops was on, which it's not now, if you played on the record, you have to play on the Top of the Pops appearance because they didn't want studio musicians. So Bowie wrote this Mata Hoople song, All Young Dudes, and the piano part was a weird chord. And he played it in the studio because they just couldn't get it. So he played this one chord. So when they're on Top of the Pops, legally, he had to play with them or they couldn't use the piano track. So Bowie is playing piano just in the background playing piano.
There was a great runner once. I remember on Letterman going, now, Paul, this song is about dudes. No, what are they? And it was like 5 minutes. Like, yeah. And what is the news? Because Paul. There's news that the dudes need to know.
All the young dudes.
Paul was trying to explain it, but it was really funny. It was like, now this, Paul, correct me if I'm mistaken. There's news and the dudes need to know
To know. It's very pertinent to the dudes.
Well, there's a really funny thing you talk about Top and the Pops. The Bonzo Dog Doodah Band have this great song called Look Out, There's a Monster Coming. And I put it on one of my Halloween CDs that I make and give to my friends. And I was on YouTube one day. I was like, I wonder if there was a video of that. And I look, and there is a video of that on Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
And they're in crazy blackface.
Oh, yeah. Well, did you know in England they had...
Oh, I can see why this didn't really...
Well, England had a show called the Black and White Minstrel Show until 1985. I'm not even kidding. It ran on the BBC till 1985 on television.
Holy shit.
The Black and White Minstrel Show, full on blackface on TV into the 80s. Have you ever seen the footage of the... fire.
Strange World of Arthur,
Arthur Brown.
Brown.
Yeah, on Top of Pops.
Amazing song.
He has his head on fire.
Yes, I have seen that. I have seen that. It's amazing.
It's fantastic.
That's a crazy song.
Yeah.
I am the god of hellfire. That is one of those songs like Surfing Bird where you can't believe the song got made. And the Who covered that song on the Pete Townsend solo album Iron Man, which was an opera based on the Ted Hughes book, which became the wonderful cartoon movie The Iron Giant.
But not Tetsuo the Iron Man.
No.
The Japanese movie.
Nor Johnny Sacco and his giant robot. Nor Ultraman.
There's a couple songs that have this all-encompassing kind of comfortable evil sound.
And yeah.
And that's one of them. And the other one is John Cale's cover of Heartbreak Hotel.
Oh, I don't know that.
Oh, you will love it. It is the evilest song I've ever heard in my life. When I heard that song, it makes you want to just stand on a stage and like scowl at people.
There are some beautiful songs with the great, and here's a couple other ones. I Put a Spell on You, one of the all-time classic evil songs.
Screaming Jay Hawkins.
Light My Fire has a great, I think it's that organ, that Vox Continental. Yep. That great carnival-y...
Yeah, the Carnival of Souls sound.
Yeah.
When you want Runaway to just be the organ solo.
Yeah. Or 96 Tears,
Have you ever heard the story about Del Shannon killing himself?
No.
I used to work at a local radio station, and they used to do these free concerts on the Hat Shell in Boston, and it would be the Monkees.
And
side note story, I was working one of those shows, and the OJs were playing, and this guy comes
not up, the famous murdering football player,
but appropriate here. and this guy comes up, and he's like this black guy, and he goes, "Hey, excuse me, what's going on here today?" And I go, "Oh, there's a free concert." And he goes, "Who's playing?" And I go, "Oh, the OJs." And he goes, "Hold up, motherfucking OJs?" And I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Backstabbers, motherfucking OJs?" And I go, "Yes, also appropriate backstabbers." So he gets on his phone and I hear him go, "Get down here, motherfucking OJ." Like he couldn't believe it was one of my favorite
backstabbers.
Also, I don't know why that reminds me of that 80s. Is it the Four Tops song where it's like, "I like opening doors, treat her like a lady."
Oh, yeah.
Either help her with a coat,
treat her like a lady.
Treat her like, I like opening doors.
one of the best songs ever about opening doors.
Exactly.
Great Hatch Shell memory from beautiful, liberal Bastion, Boston, Massachusetts.
Yep.
1991. My girlfriend at the time, who grew up just outside of Berkeley.
Okay.
Her parents are Berkeley hippies. I'm taking her to Boston. And we're going to go see Nelson Mandela speak on the Hat Show. And he's coming. It's Monday and we fly in and he's speaking there on Tuesday. My Berkeley bred California sun baby girlfriend and I are in the car. And the cab driver goes, "I'll stay away from the Esplanade tomorrow, boy." I go, "Well, what's that going on?" He goes, "The big troublemakers coming out. They're going to be out in force."
Oh, my God.
"And you watch it. On Wednesday, they're going to want it. They're going to want it all." Literally, she was like, she had gone to another planet.
Yeah, welcome to Boston.
Yeah, like she could not conceive it. Like, oh.
Was Machine open or the Ramrod when you were growing up in Boston, the gay clubs?
I don't remember. I think the Ramrod, I remember someone talking about the Ramrod.
The Ramrod's basically the movie Cruisin'. And I remember my friend Mark and I were trying to get a cab once from Lansdowne Street, and the place where the cabs were was over by the Ramrod. So we get into a cab, and the guy pulls over, and he goes, "You're not fucking queers, are ya?"
Sure.
And I'm like, "No." And he goes, "All right, get in." I was like, "Okay, thanks for that litmus test."
Andy Paley, the great Andy Paley, who does the music for this very podcast, was in a cab in Boston in the early 1980s. And he heard over the radio, "Hey, anybody want to go up to JP and pick up a load of coal?"
Oh, my God.
This is over the two-way radio. 50,000 people can hear it.
Oh,
and then
my God.
Silence. And then, "Come on, I'll owe you."
Oh, my God. Early 2000s, I'm working at Oldies 103, and the program director of the station was an ex-stage hypnotist, first of all, which was amazing. And he talked like this when he had to speak to you.
Naturally.
And he was like a jokey, you know, fun guy, so I thought you could joke around and all
hilarious
this
hypnotist.
Yeah. He was one of those people sometimes you're like, "Oh, I can joke with this guy. He's not going to get offended or something,"
right, yeah.
Which I was wrong. And so we're talking about the Oldies concerts, because he would shit on the concerts too, and like, "This guy's pathetic" or whatever.
Right.
You know, I think I was 19, so my tact was not fully formed yet, like the baby skull. You know, he goes, "Well, some of the people, they get real mad that they have to play these concerts and they have to play their oldies and they want to do new stuff." And I went, "Yeah, I mean, that's probably why Dale Shannon killed himself, because of these concerts." And he goes, "We don't joke about that here. We were mentioned specifically in his note." And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. He shot himself with a shotgun. And one of the things he cited was that he wanted to do his new music and he was just on these oldies tours. And I actually feel bad about that, just saying that at the time, but it was, you know, you're in like the zone.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And he really was like, we were specifically mentioned.
Well, the other story about Del Shannon supposedly is like Tom Petty idolized Del Shannon and then like met his bass player or something. And Del Shannon was like, please don't steal my bass player.
Yeah.
No, he's gone, baby.
Yeah. Well, like who, speaking of people that killed people, Jerry Lee Lewis shoot his bass player in the chest?
Probably.
Yeah.
I know that it was very dangerous to be his wife/cousin right. for many years. There was a joke on The Simpsons and I did not write it. And I'm pretty sure Mike Scully wrote it. Homer went to see Bachman Turner Overdrive and he's going, taking care of business. Like, yeah, taking care of business. You go, yeah, we're going to play that song, but we're going to play some new stuff first. Taking care of business. All right, all right. And then he started, he goes, and then Homer just goes, just play that part of the song.
I was at the Warped Tour in 1998. So I was working the front gate, which is right across from the T station where you go into the building. And first of all, they shut down the park for the Warped Tour, so you can't bet. I see this guy, flat cap, gets off the train, got the racing papers under his arm. He's like, today's my day. I'm going to make my money. He looks, and it says closed. He throws the racing paper down. Only time I've seen someone do this in real life. Falls to his knees and he goes, why? Like it was like his last chance for an organ or something. But that show, there was a band called Alien Ant Farm. They did a cover of Michael Jackson's Smooth Criminal.
Which, for those of you who don't realize, is the dress code for these recordings.
Yes, absolutely. So they're playing and they're like two songs in and it's Boston and people are like, fucking Smooth Criminal, smoke. And they're just yelling it. And this guy's like, we got other songs. A full bottle of Coke hits the dude in the nose and he starts bleeding. Like he's got a little blood, right? And so I thought he was going to cry and then he counts it off and they play Smooth Criminal and they leave the stage. It was three songs in.
People get reviewed every once in a while. I mean, Pryor had a big comeback like 2 or 3 years ago with the movie and the documentary and the book and they tried to do it with Hicks a few times, and you know we're old enough that we knew him.
Yes,
so which is very strange to watch him get resurrected by a generation that didn't ever see him and all that.
Yeah,
and
he was never huge.
Oh no, life. He wasn't like Pryor or Carlin.
No,
Pryor and Carlin were the top comedians in the world and were very famous. And Pryor was a movie star. I mean, more than he was a stand-up star at the end.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of people he was a movie star, especially internationally.
Yes.
They don't know the stand-up.
Yeah. Hicks
struggled in the United States to get a foothold, you know. I don't mean he struggled like he was struggling comic. I mean,
he didn't have
TV fame.
No, I will, you know, I'll tell you what he said to me.
Yeah.
When we were walking around Disney World in Orlando, Florida. We were doing the show, Robert Klein's stand-up sit-down, where you'd go on, you would do stand-up, and then Robert Klein would interview you.
Right.
And they filmed it in Orlando. And I did an episode, and Bill Hicks and I were on the same shooting day, so we shot our episodes, and we had nothing to do, so we walked around Disney World. And I remember him saying to me, they're dredging Lake Erie to put in bleacher seats for Carrot Top, and I can't sell out Saturday night at Caroline's. Like, I remember him very clearly.
Right.
Like, yeah, no, he wasn't a huge guy, but they try to. He takes on a cult. There's an occult following, which is great because it's great that his work survives.
Oh, absolutely. And he was much bigger in England. And a cat in England a couple years ago did a show sort of like, what would Bill Hicks have done about Bush and all this? And I thought, there's nothing Bill would have hated more than to have someone ape him.
Yeah.
He
really
detested that more than anything in the world. And
was this guy like smoking?
Right. I wouldn't. Oh, well, you know, like he's going to do the caustic Bill Hicks because for a lot of British people of that, from the last 20, 30 years, he's their touchstone of a great American comic that really was a rebel and took everyone on. And of course, it's been 20 years now, but I remember I said to him once, you have a CD, right? What's the one where he's standing on the sand with the microphone and the cigarette?
Arizona Bay.
And I go, you got a CD? And he goes, yeah, I got a CD. I go, why you don't sell it after the show? And he goes, what am I, Greg, a huckster?
Yeah.
And it's prevented me from selling my own stuff after the show for 20-something years.
Yes, I have said, you know, I saw George Carlin 11 times, and I never once saw him make change. But I do find I sell sometimes I will sell posters.
Oh, I sell my book.
That I will sign.
Yeah.
But it's a memento. People, I have found that like one of the new things about showbiz doing stand up is the post show meet and greet.
Yeah.
Which is a new thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's because with the internet, you have a much more direct line to your, for lack of a better term, fan base. And people feel connected to you. They follow you online. They get a daily dose.
Yeah.
And they want to pursue you. And when they come to the show, they feel connected to you. I'm the one that told them I was coming to town.
Right. And they have no distance. There's no distance. Yeah, you're not a character. No,
yeah.
You're Dana.
Yeah. And so they come up after. And I love meeting people that they come to the show, they listen to the podcast, they get a poster or whatever, we take a picture together, and it's great. It's like a complete experience. And they're always nice. It's great. Yeah.
I think that's the biggest change. Like you said, we're all our own entrepreneurs now, and that's been the best part of show business dissolving. The worst part is, of course, there's no golden prize that we're all playing for anymore because that's gone.
Yep.
But on the other hand, as Marion said to me years ago, we're all our own business.
Yeah.
And so with the podcast, I talk to everybody before the show. I walk through the crowd and shake hands with everybody, give them a sticker. And because of that, there's no distance at all.
Right.
I can start the podcast wherever I want. I don't have to go, all right, we're going to do the first 10 minutes to kind of warm you guys up. You don't have that anymore because the connection is immediate.
And your podcast all with an audience.
Yeah. Every once in a while I'll do one.
You
at
do
them my
mostly
house.
Here at Nerd Melt.
Yeah, I do it at Bar Lubitsch or Nerd Melt and on the road everywhere.
Right.
All over the world. And like next month we're in Glasgow, Antwerp, and Stockholm doing it. And then we'll end up doing it in London and Canada. Anywhere I get a gig, I make sure that that's one of the nights is a podcast. I try not to go and do stand up alone without doing a podcast on one end of it.
Oh, interesting.
Whether it's the Thursday or the Sunday. They never want to do it, of course, on a weekend because that would cut into the booze sales.
Yeah.
And then they couldn't show the video of everyone coming up. On the podcast night, I taught Glass the place, and I don't let them show the video. And it's my music and my lighting and my everything.
Oh, great.
On the other nights, you can play your crappy video before I come on. Do what you have to do to sell drinks. But my night is like, no. The music is going to be funk music that I like, and the lighting is going to be low, and I'm going to talk to everybody. I said sexy atmosphere, not a comedy club atmosphere.
Right.
Because when they play the thing of the guy getting hit in the balls and he falls off the boat, which they do in a lot of clubs, and the audience is laughing at that, and you're watching it thinking, I have to go up after this. And somehow we're all on the same Venn diagram of funny.
Yeah.
This is not what I'm trying to do.
And I think I said this to Cliff Nesteroff. I said this to Cliff Nesteroff. Like, you go to a comedy club, and behind you on the stage is a portrait of like W.C. Fields and Groucho Marx and Charlie. People have nothing to do with what you're doing
at all. The audience doesn't know who they are.
It would be as if you went to the Whiskey and it was like Brahms.
Yeah, right.
It's like, what are these? These people have no business being here. And I do like, you know, I've worked in big venues, and I would love to work in a small dark club with a low ceiling.
Yeah,
that's the best way to do stand-up.
The Punchline in San Francisco is one of my favorite places because I've worked there since I was a kid, and it hasn't changed. It's a dump, kind of small.
Yeah.
But the back wall's maybe 40, 50 feet from the stage.
Yeah.
The back wall.
Yeah.
So you're not missing anything.
You're on top of people.
Yeah. You're right up on top of them. And the Bar Lubitsch here over on Santa Monica
is a beautiful
room. It's the smallest comedy room in the world, and I love
it. I did a private show in Massachusetts recently, and I just walk in, and they go, I'm dead.
Yeah.
I'm dead.
Yeah.
Because they don't know how to do it.
Uh-uh.
And there's 11 banquet tables the size of an aircraft carrier.
Right.
The closest one to the stage is 50 feet.
I was going
to
say, there's a gulf of despair.
Yeah, they're all 100 feet apart in a sea of darkness.
And people are sitting with their back to you, so that they have to sit like this while they watch.
Yeah, and the guy, and after the show, the guy was like, what happened? Like, how do we fix this? I go like, well, everything's perfectly wrong.
Yeah.
you know, people should be sitting on top of each other, and I should be standing on top of them.
Yeah.
This is like, and it was just like, everything's wrong.
We have to be seen and heard, and that doesn't happen all the time at gigs, and people don't understand it at all.
I'm amazed that people still don't get it. It's like, have you seen comedy done before?
Yeah.
What successful comedy club do you go to where there's 100 yards between the audience and the performer?
None. They should be right below you.
Yeah.
Around you.
Yeah, totally. It's all about communication, and that's what's actually keeps you going on stage.
Absolutely. It's connecting.
Yeah, it's connecting and creating.
Because you feel like if you connect, when you don't connect, those are the nights when you're like, I don't care about this crowd. I hate you. I don't care if you're entertained anymore. I'm checking out. I'm going to read my jokes as fast as I can. Good night.
And if you're drunk or stoned
yeah.
or jacked out on coke, you're not going to connect because you have nothing to
Not relating to them at all.
Yeah.
I was in Texas a couple weeks ago.
You're in Texas a lot on this show.
For the purposes of this show, yes. And, the set was going okay. There wasn't that many people in, which I don't mind. It was like 80, 100. It wasn't a big full.
Right.
So, Saturday night, are you ready? Yeah. Oh, I said, are you ready for your... So I'm doing my thing. And it was a little vague, some of them. And I had to ride them a little. And then at the very end, and I literally was 2 minutes from the end, and I was going to do something that I hadn't done in a while because I got them finally, and I was like going to do this bit where... hilarious impressions of Charlton Heston and Charles Bronson. And
timely. Yeah. Torn from today's headlines.
Torn. At that point, at least, I felt like I'd sort of got them on my side. And the woman at the very front table, the one right under you, picked up the comment card and just started idly looking at it. Not writing on it. Idly looking at the comment card.
What city was this, Houston?
It was Arlington. Yeah. And I said to her, excuse me, can I ask you something? And she's like, what? And I'm like, I had told you I'm 2 minutes from closing here. Is there a reason why you've picked up the card in front of me now? And she went, well, you know. And so I leaned against the wall and I said, all right, I'm going to talk to you guys for a minute. I want to know something about you. What is it that you're interested in, okay? Because you paid a bunch of money to see me and you sat through a lot of it. I go, usually to comedy shows in Texas, like what, guys bring chinchillas on stage and they do flips or whatever.
Yes.
An armadillo.
Yes.
I mean, like... I've tried to dance. I've tried to sing. I've told you jokes. I've done satire. I've done knob gags. I've really tried to, I put a clown head on for, you know, whatever it takes. And at the end, what your comprehension of me is that you'd rather pick up a comment card and like fold it in your hand. And they all just, you know, now they're chastened.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? Fuck you. Right? Like, I don't need it.
Yeah.
And if that's where you're coming from, I don't care anymore about you. I don't dig it. And, like, and, well, you know, and all the other comments
thing.
Are like,
and
know.
It's a beautiful thing. Actually, I did a version last night. I was at Melrose Improv last night with the drunk I was.
Yeah.
And I did a bit where I was talking about how my, and it was Valentine's Day, so a lot of people are on dates, whatever. I was on stage and I was talking about how my parents are at the point in their lives where nothing that happens to anyone can compare to how hard they have it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm getting divorced. Your sister's Cocker Spaniel had a miscarriage in the minivan.
Right, right. The neighbors make noise. Right. They come over with their vegetables.
Right. I say miscarriage in the minivan.
Yeah.
The whole, like, six,
oh. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Right.
And I just turned and I just went, fuck you. You man up, you pussies. And it was great because if they sense that you are have no fear,
yeah.
Then it's crowd control 101.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not afraid of you.
No.
I'm not afraid of the silence. I'm not afraid of bombing.
No.
I don't get... The audience loves that because the pressure's off them. Yeah. Whenever I do a TV spot, whenever I do Conan or whatever, after the first joke, I'll always hold an extra beat and just let it be quiet. So the audience says, I'm not afraid of the quiet.
Yeah.
You're fine. We're going to get through these 5 minutes.
Right.
It's going to be great.
Here's my 20 jokes.
Yeah. And yeah, so when you do turn on the crowd, like, fuck you.
Yeah.
It's great.
I just thought, you know.
And these people.
How disrespectful.
You can't.
You're sitting in front. Sit in the back.
Yeah. And it's also with phones. You just see the light.
Oh, when it goes under the table and they think they're sneaking it on you.
Yeah. You can't do anything about it.
No, I don't know anymore. Yeah. Unless it's really flagrant, I usually leave the phone thing alone.
Yeah.
You know, because I've been beaten down like a parent.
Well, I often think submission. I often think when I do that in situations, I'm checking the set. Everything okay? Like, I'm all, if you're out, yeah, people are going to check on their kids.
So 4 or 5
if you're post, but then you see people, no, they're posting a photo to Instagram of you performing.
Right. Why don't we live this moment?
Exactly. Why don't you be in this moment and enjoy it?
Yeah.
Instead of looking back on it and wishing you were there at the time.
I was in Grand Rapids to change the Texas motif years ago. And Grand Rapids is a
needle
huge,
scratch. I feel good.
Right, is a medical community. Like, you know, their main business is medicine and doctors.
I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah. They're the one part of Michigan. It's sort of right wingy. But in any case, someone took their phone out. And it was a very well-appointed woman in fuck off pumps and a black skirt. Like, she wasn't wearing a, you know, a baseball hat and flip flops.
Professional adult.
Right. She was like, had an expensive bag and a $300 haircut. And
she took out the phone, like, flagrantly. And I went, hey, lady. You know? And I started in on her, and she went, I'm a doctor, and I'm checking something very important right now. And I went, well, okay. You know, like, I had to do a 180 and go. Then I realized there's probably 30 doctors in this room and other nurses and professional types that literally aren't.
You can also step out of the room and do that.
Well, yes. And I suggested that she might find a more private venue than my office.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, well put. Yeah.
I don't come to your office and, like, you know, like, look, clean my ears with a key, you know, like. I mean, but no one thinks about that. But I was also kind of like, oh, shit, there's probably 50 people in this room that actually have something to attend to that it just preempts my hilarity. But at the same time, like you say, take it in the lobby, baby.
I wonder how much cell phone etiquette, in the sense that so much communication now, and I include myself.
Oh, sure. We're always
I condemn myself in this. So much of our communication is texting and email. That is not genuine communication. It's and that when people are in relationships, when they end, it seems like they say that a lot of younger people, they ghost more.
Yeah.
That they just, like, don't engage in the breakup.
It's over.
They just, like, and they
I've heard
move
about
on.
This, and it's really wild.
Yeah. It's awful. And it's terrible.
Yeah. They just evaporate.
Yeah. And how much of that is from the reality of the relationship being eroded to begin with because there's not as much face-to-face, voice-to-voice communication?
I think some. I don't think you can blame it. And, of course, I blame violence on video games. No, I think you're right. The detachment and the fictional world that the phone entails, because people... I get very frustrated when people go, how do you know this? How do you know that about, you know, that fact about history or that this happened? I'm like, because I read it. Or I experienced it, or someone told me, or I watched a thing.
Yeah.
You have a magic toy that literally anything in the world can be looked up now. We live in the Star Trek episode where the library in space or whatever.
Yeah.
But you don't. You're on Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat and Periscope looking at yourself.
Looking at yourself.
Yeah. So that's where the detachment comes in and the disconnect with the world.
It's We're like, not that great.
People who do, I don't follow politics. You know how hard it is to follow politics? Go on Twitter.
Yeah.
And follow two different political things. Then you'll get nothing but politics every second of the day and a million articles curated for you. Curated. You don't even have to chase them down on your own.
I was, and we, by the way, this is the Statler and Waldorf portion of the show.
I was going to say, we need a balcony right now and I need a brocade jacket.
Yeah.
And another thing you kids did, we had to carry change.
I'm skiing.
Put it in the phones. We had to take drugs in our mouths.
I was skiing with my daughter, who you just saw clomping through here in her TARDIS bathrobe. Yeah. we were skiing, and we're on the ski lift, and we're going up the hill, and somebody's coming down. When you see those people that go down the things, like, I'm not skiing down that.
Right.
Underneath the gondola or whatever it is, the
with every chance to hit a pole.
By the way, and can we talk about, like, these? You're in these ski chairs. You're 100 feet off the ground.
Hanging.
With no bar.
Yeah. Hanging.
I can't. How did
terrifying.
That happen?
Yeah.
With no bar?
Yeah.
And people are, I don't know how people fall every day. Yeah. But some guy's skiing down the hill, and he's filming himself. He's got his phone
Surely
out.
Surely that's dangerous.
He's got his phone out on a stick, pointed at himself, and you're in mammoth California, gorgeous scenery. Like, check me out. Check me out.
If only John Muir had taken more selfies. You know what I mean? Then he would have really captured the majesty.
Ansel Adams, is his face, you can see a bit of a tree behind him.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Ansel Adams. I said John Muir. He'd have had to sketch it.
Yeah, but it's true. It's like whenever... I knew what you were doing. I knew. But it's also...
If only Sophocles could have chiseled a selfie.
If somebody... Yeah, if somebody's... And like, if somebody's Instagram, if it's like... If it's, you know, it's more than, you know, 25% selfies.
Yeah.
You know, pictures of you with a group of people, different thing.
Sure.
Just...
Yeah.
A different headshot every 2 days.
It's how people communicate now.
Yeah.
They communicate with pictures of themselves. And I'm as guilty as of anyone else. But I do believe when you're, having a sexual congress or in the majestic mountains or at the beach, it's not really that appropriate a time to take a selfie. And by the way, every moment of your life doesn't have to be immortalized. Your life's not that important.
Your life's not that important.
You're not the emperor of China.
Not every moment of it has to be immortalized. And I, that just went into another thing about people who film themselves fucking. Is there nothing else on?
Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, are you ever gonna be so bereft of entertainment that you're? Hey, let's watch when we fucked last February.
It's like the dick pic phenomenon. Really?
Yeah,
that's just sheer boredom. And if you do it, erase it immediately. Yeah, won't you?
I've never taken a dick pic.
Don't accidentally hit reply all.
I've taken 4 pictures of my feet that my dick is photobombed. But as I've said, I've said this on stage, it's like, don't ever send a dick pic. It would be as if your girlfriend sent you a photo of her feelings.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do with this.
No, it doesn't mean anything. And I don't like it as much now.
The dick pic, but that is such a male.
Oh, it's like, God.
Talk about a fundamental lack of understanding of women.
Mm-hmm.
They're not dudes with boobs.
No. No.
They don't get off.
Here, look. Like, harp.
This goes to guys' obsession with dick pics.
Yeah.
You get Playboy.
Oh, right.
Which
is
like a fantasy view of
an all-American. It's like a cheerleader. Yeah. Waxy.
Then you go to Penthouse.
Right. A little rougher. And letters. Yeah. There's more erotica.
There's more erotica.
Playboy never had erotica.
And it was a little, the girls were a little like.
Yeah, saucier.
Yeah, saucier. They'd fuck you back.
Oh, yeah.
Then you go to Hustler.
Right, Playboy was like, you're going to look at them while it happened.
Right. And then you go to Hustler, which was, the next step from Hustler was the poster over the deli of how they cut up a cow.
Yeah.
I was like, shank.
The degradation.
Yeah, I was just like, this is just cold cuts.
Yeah. And horrible cartoons that weren't funny at all, that were just vile and disgusting.
Yeah, it was,
And that was supposed to be part of the male experience.
Oh, it's awful.
Yeah.
Oh, it's awful. It's so, yeah. And it was just like, and guys suck. God, guys suck.
Yep. I would agree with that. And they prove it every day.
Stop sending photos. Yeah.
Don't take pictures of your genitalia.
I just read this book about, post-war industrialization. And, in the late 40s.
Is this the real time?
Yeah, I know. In the late 40s, the United States stood. We stood astride the world as a colossus.
Yeah.
And now we lead the globe in taking photos of our dicks with our phones.
Mm-hmm.
We are.
And arguing over whether people should have guns and healthcare.
Yeah, I know. We are chimps with machine guns.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We're a 14-year-old with a heart on.
Yeah.
It's astounding. Well, I think I said it in the book. I was talking about the ancient history, and people are like, why do people check out when there's ancient history? And I said, first of all, they never would have taken a picture of their dick in those days. They'd have cast it in bronze and hung it as a lucky lamb.
Oh, Hank, I think we're all doomed. I think if we have arrived at any conclusion, we're all doomed. The book is the smartest book in the world. The podcast is the smartest man in the world. The man is Greg Proops. Thank you, Greg.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks for having me on, Dana.
Let me validate your parking.
All right.
Here are some other celebrities that have killed people. Keith Moon.
Really?
Keith Moon ran over his chauffeur and bodyguard outside of a pub in England while fleeing from skinheads.
Oh, well, it wasn't his fault, then.
I remember he was in the car, driving the car. The car rolled over the guy's head. 2-time Democratic presidential candidate Adlai Stevenson.
Ooh.
Accidentally shot and killed a family friend at his childhood home when he was 12. Didn't realize the gun was loaded, was not charged.
Okay.
Sid Vicious, of course, killed Nancy Spungen.
Yeah, absolutely.
New Jersey Nets player Jason Williams was giving a tour of his house, playing with a shotgun, killed his limo driver.
Playing with a shotgun touring, was he using it to gesture where things are?
Do not know, but he's in prison.
What
is the difference between some of these people and Jason Williams, and why is he in prison?
Athletes versus musicians? Is that the difference?
I guess so. Now, Laura Bush was number 1, and this guy's number 12. I don't see why he's so far away from Laura Bush. Ted Kennedy.
Yes.
Famously killed Mary Jo Kopechne.
Absolutely killed her.
The one that I always find interesting is an actor that you'd see a lot, and he just seemed like a Jack Lemmon-y kind of guy, like, oh, that guy's got it all together.
Yeah.
Character actor in the 60s and 70s named Gig Young.
Was on sitcoms and all kinds of, yeah.
Was on an episode of The Twilight Zone that I actually referenced in the last episode of this podcast. He was in an episode of The Twilight Zone called Walking Distance.
Yes.
For My Money. This is like saying it's the best Beatles song.
Yeah.
But Walking Distance is, in my opinion, one of the best Twilight Zone
it's
episodes.
It's definitely up there.
Yeah. It is Rod Serling at his best. It is a touching, creepy, chilling guy visiting his hometown. He walks into his hometown and walks into his own childhood.
Yeah.
Very Ray Bradbury, very October Shadows.
October Country.
You're right. I'm sorry. Yeah. October Shadows is an art show. He sees himself as a child. His parents don't recognize him. And then his father figures out who he is and has that beautiful, heartrending monologue that I was referencing when I was talking about seeing Star Wars The Force Awakens. It's like you're visiting your childhood and somebody taps you on the shoulder and says, you can't be here.
Yeah.
You can't go back.
You can't go home again.
You can't go home again. You can't go back.
Yeah.
You can't go back. And it's heartbreaking. And Gig Young played the lead and he was brilliant in it. And he later won Best Supporting Actor at the Academy Awards in 1969. As the dance marathon MC in the film They Shoot Horses.
Oh, They Shoot Horses. What a weird movie.
Which is a weird movie. You can never get made today.
Yeah.
Karen Black, I believe.
Yeah. She was always kooky, crazy,
crazy. I was in a movie with Karen Black.
Was she as weird as she seemed?
I was not in a scene with Ms. Black.
You're talking about Burnt Offerings where you play Oliver Reed, right?
I do. Yeah. Well, I will say this. I think the best movie I'm in is out right now called Southbound, which is a really smart, fast, nasty little horror film that you can get on VOD right now.
Okay.
But I was also in a movie called I Woke Up Early the Day I Died.
Oh, yes.
Which is the last Ed Wood movie.
Yes.
I am in an Ed Wood movie.
Billy Zane is the lead.
I worked with Mr. Zane.
Wasn't that never officially released or something?
No, it wasn't. Because I'm in it.
I have it. I mean, I have
it. Oh, really? Yeah. I'd like to see. I don't have it.
I'll get you a copy. I'm
the carnival barker. I'm the guy that looks like Herc Harvey.
Yes.
You'd think that his career is now set, but it was actually
he's made it.
The beginning of the end. Other facts about him, I didn't know. From 1956 to 1963, married to Elizabeth Montgomery.
I love her so much.
So sexy.
Yeah.
And she is super sexy in The Twilight Zone that she's in with Charles Bronson.
Where she has no dialogue. Right. Yeah.
And a young Charles Bronson is up there. She's a brunette in that. And
yeah.
So delightful.
Have you ever seen The Bewitched that her kids' English class wrote?
No.
Did you know about that? She, for season,
you have more weird stories
I'm
than
sorry.
Me. You're like, I'm going to get you, Drew Friedman, and Cliff Nesteroff in a room, and it will be a black hole.
We'll never
of useless
leave.
Knowledge.
Yeah. In season 8 of Bewitched, there's a Christmas episode. Elizabeth Montgomery's daughter, I think, was in third grade in Hollywood, and she went in and said, I want you kids, because you could do that then, to write this Christmas episode. It was banned in many cities, including Boston. It never aired. And what happens is that Tabitha and her best friend, who are black,
anally raped Jesus.
And then, have you ever seen Lair of the White Worm? It's just that. She spits all over this cross. Yeah.
It's like Litzomania.
Yeah, it's very strange. Tabitha is upset that people say they can't be sisters, these two kids, because they're best friends, because they're different races. So she casts a spell where they become spotted. So she has black spots and the girl has white spots.
Oh my God.
And they have to hide it. And these kids wrote the episode. And at the beginning of the episode, Elizabeth Montgomery comes on and tells that story and says, this is, you know, a very special episode of the show. And these kids wrote it. And Boston was like, fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fucking kids.
Fuck you.
Yeah.
That is a phenomenal story. But Gig Young, it was just an interesting story. This guy that was amazing, he won the Academy Award in 1969, moves to New York. He's on his fifth marriage, brutal alcoholic.
Yeah.
In October of 1978, 3 weeks after his, I believe, his fifth marriage, found dead in his Manhattan apartment, shot his wife, then turned the gun on himself. Two weird facts that are interesting about that. One is learned later that he was under the care of a psychiatrist, Dr. Eugene Landy.
Oh.
The guy that ruined Brian Wilson.
Yeah.
Before he got to Brian Wilson, he ruined Gig Young.
They're going to say it was Frederick Wortham.
And what is amazing is that after an investigation, police stated that Young acted in the spur of the moment and his actions were not planned.
Hey, shit happens.
Yeah. In other words, this murder-suicide, it would have been a suicide murder.
Right.
You're going to plan it a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
At a certain point, every murder suicide is a little planned. You have to decide who to shoot first.
Right. Right. You make the decision on what kind of crime this will be.
Yeah. I do have the feeling that a lot of murder suicides just after the halfway point, a lot of them become just murder. Hey, I feel better now.
Yeah. Or murder. Oh shits. Which I think is a bar in Boston.
Murder. Murder.
Murder. Oh shits.
Murder. Oh shits. Come on, guys. We're going down to murder. Oh shits.
Fucking karaoke night at murder. Oh shits.
Other podcasts reach for the sky. Dana Goldbauer.
We barely try.
This has been the Dana Gould Hour, brought to you by The Internet. Music by Andy Paley, with Jake Posner behind the board. Produced by Jeff Fox. Graphic design and web production by Spencer Hunt and Segan Friend. Sound editing and post-production by Jalinda Palmer and Joe Napolitano. Hey, if you like the show, why don't you drop us a line at show@danagould.com. Tom Kenny speaking.
I said sexy atmosphere.